Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
So, Eric, what'd you think of the barbed wire everywhere match and the booking of the finish with, you know, the shark cage being opened and a bunch of sharks coming out, and then the return of Jungle Boy. We had some bad punches from Ty Conti on Ruby Soho, and a few spots that were pretty weak, but some Vulture violence and the crowd seeming to eat it up a lot of the way. I thought it was a mixed bag. What do you think?
Well, this was a Dynamite that was clearly booked to rise or fall based on the quality of the main event, because there wasn't a lot else on the show that was in doubt. And I guess I would say it wasn't an overbooked mess. There were new feuds set up, Tay Conti versus Punches, and also Ty Conti versus Padlocks. So a couple new feuds to look forward to in the coming weeks. The Anna thing, that, you know, the Ty Conti coming out and taking the controls away from Ruby Riott, who has a broken arm, courtesy of the Jericho Appreciation Society, and Conti, was pretty predictable, fairly easy to see coming. The Anna Jay thing, I don't think they set that up too much. Maybe like last week in the the trainer's room in a short little backstage segment, I believe they did. Might have even been 2 weeks ago. And, you know, and from there, it's sort of played out as you would think. The heels attack, the faces come out for the save, you know, so a little bit of botches here and there. But, you know, it's AEW. Yeah. Their crowd, their fans are forgiving. And so probably the fans went home happy. Well, they're going to have to sit through a pretty bad-looking Rampage. But if they were to be able to go home without sitting through the Rampage, they're going to go home happy.
Yeah, I'm not sure what was worse, and I, you know, there's some good stuff to talk about, but my God, those chair shots from Chris Jericho were Hogan-esque. I don't know if you missed, I think you were watching during the bad chair shot, the Hogan bad chair shot era in WCW, Eric, but my God, those weak swings of the barbed wire chair from Jericho, where it's like, I'm going to swing, but I'm not going to hurt you, and I'm going to stop before I hit you, and he did it twice. That was bad. The Ty Conti punches on Ruby were equally bad, just sort of grazing her arm over and over. There's times as a director, and you can't do it for the Jericho stuff, but you got to like cut away to something else going on when there's that many bad punches in a row being thrown. And it just did feel, I mean, like Zach Cadorn put on Twitter, do they not practice the key spot? I'll put it this way. I don't think the wrestlers involved are going to be particularly pleased with how that looks if they watch it back. Even though, like, you know, you said, the fans at AEW has are forgiving. But that's the type of stuff that for people who are skeptical of AEW will watch some of that stuff and go, all right, I mean, it was overbooked and there were some bad spots and it was kind of botched and I guess some barbed wire and blood and crashing through tables makes up for it for some people.
So I said overbooked. You say overbooked mess? Question mark.
I think it entered that zone. Yeah. You know, I mean, like I said, I mean, it had spots. I mean, we had the, you know, the platform at ringside, you know, that was built just for a spot. But you know, I mean, when it's billed as a barbed wire match going in barbed wire everywhere, I guess it's fine to have, you know, things built for a spot, but to have it like, I don't think it got used, till the post-match thing, and it's like, oh, promise fulfilled. So I don't know. It's just sometimes I just think AEW, if they dialed back, you know, 20-30% of their ideas, things would have a chance to breathe and be a lot better. Oh, what do you think of the decision? Because they talk about the shark cage getting released and then, you know, the chaos and the excitement and the adrenaline of the baby faces running out to even the odds, but having this be – and the women and an angle at ringside with the women. So, yeah, it was overbooked mess. But to have Sammy be involved in the finish and to have, you know, Jericho, in, you know, to have the match end the way it did, how would you have booked it differently? What decision might you have made?
Well, I assume from the start that Jericho was going to win for two reasons. One, Kingston took the first match, and we know Jericho is willing to go 50-50 with wrestlers, or
sure.
Orange Cassidy and MJF being two of the examples that immediately come to mind. Jericho also said he's never lost when he's been doing the Painmaker gimmick, which is mostly a New Japan thing up until this point.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of his the demon for Finn Balor. And so, you know, Jericho was going to win. The question was going to be how. How was he going to be screwed? Obviously, he was going to be screwed when the heels got out of the cage, because that's happened in every pro wrestling. Heels hanging over the manager, hanging over the top of the arena in a cage since the 80s when I first started watching wrestling. Jim Cornette, et cetera, et cetera. J.J. Dillon, I think. So the question was how. And to me, the finish made sense because, as the announcers pointed out, Kingston tossed Sammy off the top of the cage in the Blood and Guts match. How many weeks ago was that? Was that 3 weeks ago? So that's, yeah, 3 weeks
yeah.
ago.
Yep.
So that was longer than, I think AEW usually keeps guys off TV for a week or two. I guess by their standards, that wasn't rushed, right? The return wasn't rushed. I'll allow it, I guess. it made good sense to screw Kingston out of victory. Kingston, really, his barometer for success in the match, he laid it down in the promos before, was drawing Jericho's blood, failed to do at Blood and Guts, so he got to do that here. So everybody's a winner in the end.
How do you feel about babyfaces setting the standard that it's not about winning, it's about something else, and that's the sort of, not just sort of, these maybe obvious portending of the fact that the face is going to lose but get a moral victory. I mean, I get why they do it, but it can be sort of transparent when they do it, and it sort of takes some of the, I guess, the agony of defeat away when the heel wins and the babyface loses, and that should mean something and drive the fans to, you know, cheer for the next babyface against the next heel. And instead, it's you don't even feel it because, well, Eddie doesn't care about winning or losing. It's just about drawing blood. Obviously, he cared about winning, you know, but I mean, it didn't bother him that much because, hey, the final thing is his music got to play if they wanted it because he threw Jericho through that platform at ringside.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for a couple reasons. Generally, to answer your question, I'm not in favor of it. It's babyface is going to lose the title match, but he drew blood, so he's, you know, it's that kind of concept. Generally not great. In this case, Kingston can probably get away with it because, one, he already has a win in his pocket over Jericho in a singles match. His team also won the Blood and Guts, right? Claudio Castagnoli scored the winning submission. And then, you know, Kingston was going to get his heat back, and he's kind of a wrestler for whom, you know, he was in position, if anyone ever was in a match like this, to just care about inflicting punishment as a babyface instead of winning the match, which would have been a pleasant side effect, I'm sure, for Kingston. But, you know, normally it doesn't work. It didn't bother me as much with Kingston for those reasons. What do you think?
No, I think you make the case. But, I mean, you kind of have to explain it all. And if to me, it just comes across as we want it both ways or always. And so it just feels a little convoluted, I guess. I mean, but it's logical. Like, a lot of things are logical when you are sitting there booking it out, talking it through with wrestlers. But in the end, if you have to talk that long to kind of explain or rationalize why something in the end just wasn't more straightforward, I think it's a sign that it can backfire or just sort of numb people to it all just sort of feels even in the end. And, you know, the idea of Jericho, well, you know, he wants his win back if he gives one up. It's like, why not just lose a feud? You know, you're 51 years old. You're not going to be at the top of the card. You're not what you were even 3 years ago in the ring. But there's a lot left he can give, but I don't think it ruins him because he's still so good on the microphone. I mean, probably the best thing on Dynamite in the last month was Jericho's promo last week, but I don't know that I'd have to think about that, but
I mean,
it's in the conversation. Go ahead.
They might be setting up Jericho Moxley, maybe the backup plan at All Out.
Yeah.
If they can't, I mean, who's the biggest star with Punk not around, if Danielson's not around, you know, I think they could be setting him up as he could be the backup plan. Or, you know, Danielson had a tweet where he said he wanted to kick both the behinds of Jericho and Kingston. So, you know, they could be setting up a three-way between those guys at All Out. But to your point about having to explain everything, not to get all rich fan pop culture on you, but there was an 80s movie that played on HBO every day one summer. It was a B movie called Big Trouble in Little China. I'm sure there would be a lot of objectionable stuff today, but one of the things I remember about that was Kurt Russell and Kim Cattrall, who was on Sex and the City later. Characters would just spit out breathlessly like 5 minutes of exposition in like a soliloquy, right? To try and paper over this thin plot. And that's Excalibur plays that Kim Cattrall role on Dynamite every week where, oh my God, Excalibur's going to have to say a breathless thing to explain something to the fans, right? And in like rapid fire fashion. And it's,
that's well put,
I guess if you like AEW, maybe you find that endearing or you just kind of roll your eyes at it. If you don't like AEW, I could see or find more faults with it than not most weeks. Probably that drives you crazy and it's something you could mock.
There could be a little graphic on the screen that for those of you who aren't on social media all week and haven't watched Rampage or AEW Dark and aren't thinking about AEW and everything that happened on Dynamite and Rampage over the last 3 months, Excalibur is about to say something to catch you up, so listen carefully for the next 12 seconds.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that is the formula, right? The announcers have to paper over everything because they won't do video packages because people change the channel during them. I'm sure their research shows. So at most, and in recent weeks, I think we've gotten more like 15 to 30 second video recaps than we used to get, almost none. So, I mean, it's a step in the right direction, I guess. They're trying to meet Wade Keller halfway.
Yes. Well, For the opening match, I mean, showing what Brody's done to Darby and Darby getting, you know, some revenge after, you know, a week later. It's like, that was good. Like, and they're doing it, you know, sort of a inset screen during ring entrances. And that is meeting halfway or, you know, I mean, I'm not even advocating that like halfway is perfect. It's just a smart thing to do regardless of what WWE is doing. And, you know, the idea that people are going to tune out during a video package, like how insecure are you about your fan base and viewership that you think you're just one video package away. And then you're ignoring the notion that there's a ton of people out there who are just not tuning in at all because when they watch Dynamite, they feel lost or just not as fully engaged because Dynamite's the only time they think about AEW during the week. Or, you know, they're not coming prepped with, you know, a study guide or having studied for the show. And some of those people just are less engaged. And I think it's a net positive to engage people. Certainly that's a choice WWE makes. It's not like WWE does video packages because they think video packages draw better ratings than live action in the ring and that it's better for the live audience. They do it because they think it's really important to do it. It's not like they pay per minute to have a live camera pointed at the ring and they're trying to save money. It's a choice and there's a rationale and a reason behind it. And I think AEW is moving closer to doing that the right way for the big stuff. But the little stuff, you know, Anna Jay, it's like, I mean,
both promotions think their audiences are dumb. WWE thinks you need everything explained to you and spoon-fed and jammed down your throat 15 times so you don't forget and you know what's important. AEW thinks their fans have such low attention spans that they're going to change the channel. So that's where we are in the year 2022, folks.
And I think AEW is sort of, in this case, I don't know if it's just to counter-program WWE or because of taking the minute-by-minutes too literally in the micro, like, oh, look, the ratings went down X percent. You know, it's sort of like bean counters who are like, well, if you do this, you'll make more money this month. And it's like, well, right, but by doing – or even the Raw going 3 hours. It's like, well, we can look at the numbers. They make this much more money. It's like, well, are they in the aggregate making more money or are they driving people away who would watch a 2-hour show but won't watch a 3-hour show? Are they hurting buy rates and WWE Network subscriptions because 3 hours exhaust fans instead of leaving them wanting more? How many intangible, unmeasurable, unknowable ways, but sort of logically, are they costing themselves a lot of money that may or may not more than offset that third hour? And that's what I'd say about video packages. You can't measure it. It's subjective and different people are going to have different opinions on it, but you know, the criticism of AEW you hear a lot is it's too densely packed. There's no time to breathe. And there's a lot of things, like you said, where you need that Excalibur explanation that almost becomes a parody of itself at times. And we got that on this show. Even though, you know, as you said, it was built around the main event. It wasn't, you know, even 2 days ago, it wasn't like if you went on social media, AEW social media, it wasn't like there was a ton. You know, they weren't able to say loaded show or stacked show, I think is what they called it last week in their social media. I don't think they bragged that it was this week, even though, I mean, Brody King and Darby Allin is cool, and we got some Ricky Starks, FTR action, we got or FTW action, and, you know, Christian Cage back in the ring. I won't say he wrestled, but he was back officially in a match with Luchasaurus. I mean, they had some things they can sort of, you know, Jade Cargill in action, but it didn't feel like last week did, which was 2 hours of a pay-per-view level lineup. This felt more like a standard wrestling TV show with a big gimmick main event with a couple of big stars.
Two things. One, yeah. I am confident, I don't have any sources on this, but I would venture to guess Tony Khan and Chris Harrington, the Mookie on Twitter, who used to run WrestleNomics before Brandon Thurston so ably took it over, that they sat back for the first few months and they saw what happened when they put a video package on and saw that it was death with their audience. And they said never again. And so for them to even do these little 20-second, 30-second packages is, you know, it's hard on their part, one. And then two, you know, you raise a valid question of how much business, you know, which for AEW is weekly television viewers for Dynamite and Rampage, how much does the lack of sort of explaining even a little bit more than they do, how much does that cost them with viewers and pay-per-view buys? I don't know that we know the answer to that. I mean, you could draw some conclusions based on where the television ratings were versus where they are now, you know, last September versus, you know, as we approach August a year later. But, you know, of course, there's other factors to account for, like half the main stars are injured. And TV viewership as a whole tends to be down this summer for all channels. But, you know, you could maybe draw that conclusion. So you could also look at the last pay-per-view buy rate, this sort of outlier, this weird Forbidden Door card that they absolutely did not do enough to introduce these New Japan wrestlers to the AEW audience, generally speaking, outside of Will Ospreay, who actually got match time, but if not a ton of promo time.
Yeah.
Zack Sabre Jr., great promo. So how much I think you had it at 80,000, 85,000 buys. Maybe you went up to 100 after Okada's appearance.
Yeah.
I had my range was 100 to 120, maybe 100 to 125. I can't remember what I tweeted. WrestleNomics reported.
I think you said 127, Eric, if I remember your tweet.
I don't think so. I think I think it might have been 120.
Okay.
That was at the high range, right?
Come on,
so
I'm telling
I undershot
you
it as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I guess the question to me after that was, I'm surprised it's that high, 127,000, according to WrestleNomics citing sources, which I assume are accurate, but we'll know in 6 months. But how many more thousands or tens of thousands of buys would they have gotten if they had done that, if they had invested fans a little bit more? So it's not that the pay-per-view did bad. It's how much better could Forbidden Door have done if they had done just a little bit, just even the bare minimum of that, given Zack Sabre Jr. a promo, told you who these people were in video packages outside of the preview show that airs after Rampage, you know, late at night.
Yes.
On a Friday night.
Yes. And what's the opportunity cost, you know, of lost momentum, of developing your storylines for Dynamite, for Fyter Fest, for Quake at the Lake, for and ultimately for All Out? What kind of lost momentum is there when suddenly, you know, Jay White and Zack Sabre Jr., I mean, like when these guys are getting not a ton of TV time, others a lot of TV time, what opportunity cost is there to Hangman Page or getting Miro reintroduced or establishing some things that are happening on the undercurrent, on the shoulder content, and having that be more prominent on Dynamite? You know, what kind of momentum is lost? And that's subjective. But they kind of put a lot of things on hold to add another pay-per-view, which will be profitable and absolutely beat my expectations. And, you know, I said we're going to learn, you know, and I learned from that in terms of what the kind of almost default interest level is for the novelty of an AEW New Japan show. And it was considerably closer to a typical average AEW pay-per-view buy rate level than I expected. And that's good new information to have going forward. But I think the question is not only what could they have done more for that event, but what more can they, how much bigger is their audience if they do start kind of tweaking and changing some things about how they promote, you know, in terms of focusing on stars and not having Excalibur be the person explaining things. Maybe not. Maybe this is just this formula is maxing out what a company with AEW's philosophy can do. But I talked with Jason Powell on the flagship about this, and you know, Jason and I both agree. I think there's more room to grow, and that's where any critiques or criticism come from, is there's room to grow if they tweak some things in terms of, you know, just stepping back and going, are there some things that we're doing that we should stop doing, and, you know, some things we should be doing that we're not doing? And I just don't know if Tony slows down enough to do that, because things are going well enough, remarkably well enough, when you look at the total landscape and what your expectations are for various things, whether it's demo rankings and cable or, you know, the New Japan combined show buy rate. I mean, and as Tony says, he's predicting a very big deal, a very big TV deal next time around. That could be just playing the PR game and setting expectations high. But it also, my hunch is he genuinely believes that. And they're probably going to be in line to be quite a profitable company compared to even now when that next TV deal comes around. So, you know, I mean, it's not a disaster, but boy, I think when people are AEW fans, think about how much more they like AEW than what WWE has been serving up and how much more it meets what they're looking for. I just think there's a lot of fans out there who haven't been quite brought in to the strengths of AEW yet, because there's some things about the way AEW promotes that keeps them from coming on board. I think people who are AEW fans should think Dynamite should be drawing after 3 years what SmackDown is drawing, or at least what Raw is drawing, despite the huge head start. And, you know, they've got a long ways to go, and Rampage is fledgling, and the difference between NXT, as awful as that show has been lately, and Dynamite isn't what it probably should be in terms of the difference in quality between the shows.
The question of more promos versus not, you know, staying the course comes up a lot on The Fix with Todd Martin. Between the two of you, go VIP. It's really the best wrestling podcast you'll hear all week, pretty much every week of the year. So put that over. But I guess the key question boils down to, and we don't know the answer to it because AEW won't do it so far, but is there more to be gained by letting things breathe a little bit more and recapping key angles and putting more of an emphasis on the world title and things like the world title and the big angle of any show? Could you grow your audience more than you maybe would lose from those who are turned off by the video packages or flip the channel, right? And that it's always hard to get people back because they might get distracted by their phone or some other TV show or a sporting event on TV. What is the answer to that question? I would love to have the answer, right, as a fan. I mean, to some extent, I'm going to watch Dynamite every week. I'm going to watch Rampage every week. If they did more video packages, I'd just fast forward through them if I didn't find them interesting. But I tend to find when they do those preview shows for the pay-per-views, they're incredible. They're, like, very well done.
That's
just
nobody sees. They're good at it. They're good at this,
And the only time you really get a more of a heaping helping of those promos is right before a pay-per-view, usually on the go-home show, because that's when the special is done, right? That's when the half-hour thing is done, so they've got it in the can. And they will do a 30-second version of it, a one-minute version maybe if you're really lucky, and you get to see a little bit. But they just don't do that week to week, and it's an obvious deliberate choice. And maybe it's time to do it just to settle this bet between Wade Keller and Todd Martin. Nothing else.
Because it is a big topic in terms of frequency and quantity, it's not even, like, I think the most important thing for AEW to fix or change. To me, it's just creating more of a sense of hierarchy and who the biggest stars are. And not repetition, but more frequency of focusing longer and more often and more consistently week to week on your top stars and top storylines, instead of kind of the every 2 or 3 week approach to some of the top things going on. And the thing is all of, and I say this all the time, and I hope it doesn't seem too repetitive, but, or even like hedging or weaseling in my criticism, but I think it's only fair to bring up every single time the asterisk that Tony Khan's dealing with massive injury issues. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, between the pandemic and then Hangman Page with his leave when he became a dad, that went a little longer than expected and kind of killed some momentum there. And then you got, you know, Kenny Omega, and there's been issues with the Bucks, and now, and then the Cody situation, the MJF situation, and now Punk and Danielson and on and on. It's just like, I hesitate to be too critical of certain things that otherwise I would be about the AEW product. I'll just, you know, put it that way. But so I'm more just expressing in the totality of what we've learned about Tony Khan's booking, having a tighter bench, to use a basketball analogy, I think would be better for him. But I want to pause there and get back to specifics about Dynamite and not spend any more time on big picture stuff, at least not at the moment. And pause and introduce the show, because we're deep into this and we haven't done that yet. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Wednesday, July 20th, 2022. And I'm Wade Keller, host of the program, the editor of the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter and pwtorch.com, and the host of a bunch of pro wrestling podcasts throughout the week, including some VIP exclusive ones like the aforementioned Fix with Todd Martin, which will drop tomorrow night, Thursday night, for VIP members, Everything with Rich Fan, post pay-per-view roundtables, Wade Keller hotlines, and more. And also our free shows that are ad-free for our VIP members, the Wade Keller podcast and post shows. The other voice you hear is Eric Kroll, a former Pro Wrestling Torch columnist and a longtime mainstream Chicago-based reporter covering politics for much of that. And he is a frequent co-host here on the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. Eric, welcome back to the co-host chair.
Hey, Wade, thanks for having me back.
Great to have you back. We invite our listeners to call us every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday night. We start 5 minutes or so after Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown. And if you are downloading our show and listening later, as the vast majority of you do, thank you. When it works for your schedule and you can tune in live, you can find us at WadeKellerPostShow.com or click the link at PWTorch.com in my TV reports covering Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown. Or you can also find us on the link to the live stream on our Twitter account at PWTorch. Consider yourself formally invited to join the conversation, agree, disagree, or just suggest various topics. The place to call, the number to call, is 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558. And when you call, push 1 on your keypad. That place you want our switchboard so we know that you want to be brought onto the show. You can also email us at WadeKellerPodcast@PWTorch.com. WadeKellerPodcast@PWTorch.com. We've definitely got some emails on that main event, which we'll be getting to momentarily. We've got Javier Machado from Miami, who will be joining us for the roundtable segment coming up in a bit. We did not get anybody who was attending tonight telling us they'd be our on-site correspondent. So if you're listening in your car on the way home from the show, although they're probably taping Rampage right now, but if you left early, give us a call and let us know what it's like. And you're invited to let us know ahead of time if you're attending any upcoming Raw, Dynamite, or SmackDowns. You can email WadeKellerPodcast@PWTorch.com and let us know that you want to be the on-site correspondent for the event that you're attending. And put the name of the city in the subject line. That way we can search for it when the date is approaching and get in touch with you and arrange for you to be on the program. Okay, with that done, let's get to our calls. And we'll begin with Derek in Utah. Derek, thanks so much for calling and holding during that opening discussion. What's on your mind about Dynamite tonight?
I like the show. I think I like the barbed wire match a little more than you. Mostly just because I thought even though the interference could be seen as excessive, I do think it built some twists and turns that added drama to the finish. I don't think the after pinfall stuff was necessary at all, but I was entertained. And the other high point of the show for me that I feel kind of guilty about is I really like the opener with Brody King and Darby Allin.
Oh, that was
but,
good.
With this reservation, though, as an older guy now, 37, I see Darby out there just getting destroyed in a way that no matter how tough he is, that can't be sustainable and it can't be healthy. And I almost just feel like kind of guilty. Like, I like this. And does that mean I support child abuse or masochism or something? Because I just don't see a way that he can continue to allow others to throw him around that way and have any sense of longevity in wrestling or a healthy mid-age. So your thoughts on that?
Yeah. First of all, I really like the match. I thought it was a star-making, dominant performance from Brody. And this gets – actually, it's a good example of sort of the nuance of my top booking critique of AEW, which I think is considerably more important than video packages, which is, you know, probably 4, 5, or 6 on my list of things AEW could do to improve. Number one is just when you get a new star, like when you sign somebody new, work more to establish who they are and feature them in matches that really show off what you want them to be known for, what you want fans to think of when you think of them, and not lean so much on their reputation that you know, in Tony Khan's mind, he has from watching them or assuming or his assumption of what the fans know about that wrestler or think about them. If Brody King was doing this for a few weeks on television, not only on Dynamite, but you could have a match on Rampage. And this is where, like, quote, video package, I think, gets a bad name. Because to me, if Brody King had this kind of match and they found the right types of opponents and they just did this for weeks on end and he wasn't taking any falls and he wasn't really selling too much, and then you're also interviewing him on Dynamite on a week he's not wrestling, but maybe he wrestled on the previous Rampage, that's where the interview, you know, Shivani says, we've got Brody King here. Brody, I want to show fans who didn't see last Friday what you did. Boom, you show, 15 seconds of highlights of what he did in the match. You go back to Brody. Nobody's changed the channel, and you've caught people up on Brody as done, or maybe it's a little video package coming in and out of a break that is, you know, 12 seconds that says, coming up next week on Dynamite, Brody King in action. Some of it is just framing somebody as the person who the booker or the promotion has picked to be the big star that you should pay attention to because their journey is aimed at the top of the card against some top stars who are already established. And Brody's just with a lot of people who have been signed where they sort of meander and they're sort of there, but it doesn't feel like there's a game plan as much as they just drop, you know, Tony just drops them in here and there to kind of do his thing. This was, I thought, a star-making offensive performance, and Darby was a huge part of that, but Brody played his part really well, and I thought it was compelling storytelling and drama. Now, that is my analysis if this was an animated series or CGI series, but there was a real human being out there, and that is also part of what Derek is bringing up. Darby, you know, it's what he does. He takes these beatings. He's very lightweight, and so, you know, the impact is just from a physics standpoint, I guess a little bit less, and he's very good. He's practically a professional stuntman at this point in terms of what he does, but I don't know how many people watch that and are thinking about how he's going to feel in, you know, 12 or 14 years physically when they watch him, but I thought it was a great performance from Darby, and the type of match you want Brody King in, if the decision has been made to feature him as a big single star or just a big threat against other big names. And certainly, they set things up with Miro, Sting, and Darby against House of Black at this point. So, Eric, your thoughts on any of that?
I mean, I guess the analog for Darby Allin in the 90s would be Cactus Jack McFoley, right? Darby is the Cactus Jack of 2020s.
Without
Darby
the hip
maybe,
padding.
Yeah. Darby may be in wrestling for a good time, but he may not be in a wrestling ring for a long time. He is straight edge, so, you know, you see what happens with Jeff Hardy, all the pain he's in all the time and what's kind of the repercussions have been. Maybe that helps Darby, although, man, I don't know if he takes pain medication or not, but, man, even an Advil the morning after a match like tonight. So tonight, one of the themes on Dynamite were rehab wins, rehabilitation wins coming off a loss, and there were two of them. One was Ricky Starks over the former Two Dimes from NXT. Ricky Starks, I think, took the fall in the tag title match the week before, so he needed a rehab win. And Brody King did you know, did the honors losing to Jon Moxley in the hastily put together AEW interim world title match. Was that 2 weeks ago, maybe? Maybe it was even.
Imagine they flipped those two matches around.
Right. It was last week, I think. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Brody King winning over Darby, or winning a battle royal, or, you know, making Darby and Brody King and everyone contenders. Well, however you got there, Brody would have benefited from this win before his facing Moxley, for sure. And they easily could have done that.
Better than a battle royal win.
Yeah.
Even though that's a memorable finish that's been looping on AEW social media for 2 weeks, it's still, you know, it's about winning matches like this that make people go, oh, my God. You want to suck people in and go, I think this is Moxley's maddest match. This is going to be crazy. And then you spend 2-3 weeks having them cut promos and go back and forth and talk to each other and make that the centerpiece of the month of AEW TV and then deliver big time on it and get more out of it. I mean, I'm stepping on your bill, Eric.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so it's a rehab win, but it's an expensive one. You know, Ricky Starks beat a guy who got dismissed from NXT for a positive test. It's a positive test of what? I don't think we know, allegedly. And but, you know, Darby is one of AEW's four pillars. They don't really talk about that anymore. But you know, they still, I think they have Darby and Jungle Boy lose a little bit too much for my tastes. That said, Brody was the most over he's been in AEW. I mean, the crowd in some of Brody's matches has been silent. Placement, maybe that's because they didn't introduce him out. I mean, they introduced him in House of Black vignettes, but we didn't really know that much about Brody King other than he was a member of the House of Black. You know, there was a very NWO era WCW post-match angle here. And, you know, it sets up potentially, although, you know, Miro came out and stared, but they do have a little wiggle room if they want Miro. You know, I don't think Miro is going to be heel because his t-shirt literally said, I am redeemed, which would sort of be a babyface thing to be redeemed as opposed to not being unredeemed. Would be more of a heel devil kind of thing. So, you know, they set up a 6-man with Sting, Darby, Miro versus the House of Black. Did they refer to Miro getting blasted with the mist by Black at Forbidden Door? Because that, you know, that's Miro's motivation for being mad at Black. I don't know if they did or not.
I don't remember if they did either when Miro was coming out. I don't recall it, but I mean, there was, you know, as usual, a lot going on there.
So, you know, if they didn't, well, that's something they left on the table because that is Miro's motivation for being mad at Black. You know, you could do tag teams, you could do six mans, you could do singles matches. You know, you could do Brody King versus Miro before you get to Black versus Miro. I imagine they probably have Miro Black pegged for the pay per view, All Out. But if they don't, you know, that's another. The winner of that could be positioned for a title match. I don't know that you could headline All Out with that match, but you could certainly headline a Dynamite with that if you wanted to give Moxley another interim title defense, right? To winner of a big singles match between those two upper mid card guys who potential to be utility players who get moved up into the top mix. So. Yeah, a lot, you know, a pretty satisfying opening match other than Darby having to eat a pin.
Yeah. Let me throw back to Derek either for follow-up on what we said or another topic.
Well, Wade, I thought you brought up an interesting and very valid point when you brought up momentum and guys rising up the rankings. And I just think about it and between all the podcasts I listen to, there's been this expression that you just used, star-making performance, and it's been used for Brody King tonight, Takeshita a few weeks ago, Dante Martin, among others that just spring in my mind. And the issue with that is they were star-making performances that didn't make anybody a star because the follow-up was not there. And I just think about a shortcoming of AEW, and I do think it is the ability for guys to gain momentum, meaningful momentum, and also sustain momentum. And I think another example of that is there's a lot of guys who have come from NXT/WWE, and the highest they were on the card, response-wise, and I think the highest point in their AEW tenure was their debut. I mean, the ones that come to mind right off my mind, Aleister Black, Adam Cole, Andrade, the hottest they were is the first week they showed up. And now they are they are not in the same place they were when they arrived. And I think when people criticize, rightfully so, WWE's booking, that's what they say. These guys get, like, trapped in the mid-card and they never are elevated. Well, Adam Cole was a much bigger deal in NXT than he was in AEW. And Aleister Black was very promising, and he had a very good career in NXT and had promise in WWE that never panned out. And now where is he? He's on Rampage doing random tag team, six-man tags every once in a while. So that's definitely something they need to correct, I think. And it kind of gets to my second point, which, because he had a slight cameo today, was Hangman Adam Page, who was supposed to be their homegrown main star, because everybody else on their roster who's in the upper card is from somewhere else, if they care to admit it or not. And I just think to myself, he showed up in a cameo. I was like, what happened with Hangman? And more importantly, for conversation's sake, what do they do with Hangman Page? Because this can't be a place that he's comfortable with, and it can't be a place that he stays if this is kind of the high watermark level for guys that they're trying to build up. So your thoughts on what's next for Hangman?
Yes. So, Eric, I want you to comment on that. But Derek also made the point, wrestler's best moment in AEW is their debut match. And it's not that they crash into oblivion and uselessness, but that AEW doesn't, the way they promote and book, elevate the stars that they acquire. Is that mostly true, almost always true, or an overrated or flawed premise to put out there where you just choose selective options, but it's really not fair? Like, what were you thinking as Derek from Utah explained that?
Yeah, I mean, I think Derek raises a valid point with some of the folks who've been pushed. I thought Aleister Black was one of the hottest acts in the promotion coming off his feud with Cody, and I thought they could have hot-shotted him into a TV, you know, a world title match on television, or, you know, some kind of title match on television. Adam Cole, they got you know, two world title matches out of him. The outcome was never in doubt, but they did, you know, shoot him to the top of the card. So he got his
run.
Did
they, though? I mean,
for what their purposes were, they did.
But they did. They barely talked about the match before it happened. They barely talked about it after it happened. It was, people were upset.
He got a rematch on TV, didn't he? For reasons that still escape me to this day after he got beaten clean at the pay-per-view, he got a rematch on TV.
And then you had the baggage or the dark cloud of the Orange Cassidy loss as, you know, the precursor to it. It's not about, like, I worry sometimes that it's like, well, they got a main event, and so therefore they're getting pushed in their big stars. But is Adam Cole really a bigger star or a greatly diminished star compared to how he's portrayed in NXT? Has he been given the freedom or hasn't been as engaged in booking and letting other people take the lead because he's not a senior member? Whatever the case is, does he seem diminished when he's out there doing goofy stuff that feels more like it's for Dark Order than it's for the guy who was at the head of NXT? Like, he's a prime example of somebody who, if you have a little more or quite a bit more thought that goes into caring for him and protecting him and projecting him as a star, you'd be better off. I don't think just throwing him in a couple title matches is enough to go, look what we got out of him.
He's still super over, or maybe that's just the ring entrance, you know. I know Adam Cole has had some injuries. I know I'm going to get heat for saying this because it's very Cornette-y point. I don't think he looks the part of main event wrestler. I think he'd have to, you know, the Young Bucks can get away with it because they're a high-flying tag team. Adam Cole is wrestling these singles matches. So to me, I find it harder, you know, outside of NXT, I find it a little bit harder to buy him in that role. I think they did get you know, compared to some of the other signings, they got more out of Adam Cole, I think, than Aleister Black so far, than Andrade, than even Miro, who had a great TV title run. And then I thought, you know, should have gotten a world title match at some point, you know, just great act that is kind of universally loved, Miro.
Yeah.
And then he disappeared for a long time to shoot television pilots and movies and maybe
and have sex with his wife.
According to his promos. And, you know, are there a lot of guys, to Derek's point, are there a lot of guys AEW signed, brought in, and didn't get the most out of? Yes, absolutely. Are there guys that AEW has elevated? Your Sammy Guevara's, MJF, Darby Allin, Jungle Boy, and Wardlow? Yeah. I mean, so, you know, and that gets at the problem that, you know, I know Todd Martin has talked about at The Fix, one of his great frustrations with AEW is the lack of mobility up and down the card. There's, you know, one Tony Khan stingy with putting top guys against each other, and then not probably, you know, because he's either saving matches and or doesn't want guys to do jobs so he can keep them strong, which I guess is inevitable. And any wrestling company, guys just time immemorial don't want to do jobs even in this era. And so here we are. To get to Derek's other point, you know, as the resident Hangman Page stan of the Torch contributors. It's been really frustrating for me. He is their home, you know, supposed to be their homegrown main star. He had a world title reign that I was higher on than most, but even I will admit, you know, started off with great promise with a 60-minute draw with Bryan Danielson, and then the rematch was great too. And then he just sort of disappeared from TV more weeks than not a lot of the time, Lance Archer and then the Cole thing. And it certainly didn't reach the heights. It certainly is not, hopefully not his signature title reign. He's been reduced to interrupting Dark Order promos the last 2 weeks. This time he made the save. A couple things might be true, and none of them are great. One, they had a plan for Hangman Page after coming out of Double or Nothing in Forbidden Door. You know, he did not have the title. He didn't get a singles match versus Okada that everybody kind of wanted to see, at least, you know, many people wanted to see. Maybe his next opponent, his next feud, the person who he was supposed to face, maybe that person's injured, right? Entirely possible, because he's one of their top guys. It is also possible that what's next for Hangman Page is they may be building to a reuniting of the Elite, you know, a three-year storyline where they broke up with Hangman Page and the Bucks and Kenny Omega, and now they're all going to reunite as faces to take on Adam Cole and Kyle O'Reilly and Bobby Fish. Hopefully they'll get, I guess that's 3-on-3, but you know, the Adam Cole side doesn't feel to be as star studded as the, I guess Adam Cole would need a fourth there, right? If it was going to be 4-on-4. So maybe they could find somebody to boost Adam Cole's the star power on his team. But I mean, I think that may be where you're headed next, but before the end of the year. And if that was the case, I'd love to see the payoff to that storyline. And I would enjoy it greatly. And but is that where they're going? Who knows? It certainly doesn't look like it now, does it? It,
to me, the way Hangman's being booked, it looks like Tony's lost confidence in him. I mean, I felt that way during his title reign. I mean, I'm not saying that's true. I'm not saying it's not true. But you don't watch that and think this is an ex-world champion who's gearing up for a push. I mean, he's I don't know. Yeah, it's just – but, you know, wait and see. I mean, because they're – I don't want to punt on every critique of AEW, and obviously I don't, but there's so many injuries, and, you know, we're coming out of the New Japan thing. We're kind of trying to co-hype this ROH pay-per-view, which we'll get to, Eric, and the choices they made in doing that. And, you know, we'll shift into All Out hype soon and really get focused on that, obviously. You know, they already are to a degree, but I mean, they're going to start overtly talking about it and hyping it once the ROH thing is done, and not just try to get ticket sales, but build matches. And so I guess I want to take a more of a wait and see approach with Hangman before drawing any strong conclusions. But when you end up just being the guy who runs in to help, you know, John Silver handing Butch t-shirts, it's just dumb. And it's not protecting Hangman, and it's going back to something that was criticized back when it was happening, but the idea was, well, it's building a story and he'll move on from it. And now he's back to it. So
yeah,
it's
a mix of, we want you on TV because you're a big star for us, but we don't have anything for you to do.
Yeah. And I mean, that would be an AW, don't do this, but Eric, you and I watch wrestling, where it was the thing that was done is sometimes you just have a match. And it's a lopsided match where a star wins, and it gives the fans and it gives the fans a chance to cheer or boo, depending on the role the wrestler's playing. And you get to enjoy the ring entrance and their signature moves, and the announcers get to talk exclusively or almost exclusively about that wrestler and what they've been up to and what their aspirations are and what's happening next, and establish the name of their move and what their finisher is, and it gets done unencumbered without interference. And then their music plays and they celebrate and you feel good about it. And the whole thing takes 5 minutes and there's no commercial break or split screen break. And then you move to the next thing. And that gives you a chance to breathe. That's why songs aren't just choruses. And Hangman could use that right now. And I think the shows would be better if they had it. But there's this fear of minute by minute ratings. And it's like, you don't grow a garden by pouring more water on the seeds. I mean, you've got to understand that it takes a variety of things to maximize the growth of your company and protecting your stars and building your stars. And sometimes that involves just having a match that's not an angle, that isn't breathless, and that doesn't feel desperately scared that you're going to lose your viewers once and for all because you put a match out there that doesn't have blood, barbed wire, interference, a distraction finish, lights flickering on and off, or stuff going on at ringside. And Hangman would benefit from that formula right now. And you can tell the story that he had a world title run. Where is he now? Where's his head at? And he's working his way back up again, but he's building up some wins and rebuilding his confidence. And I'd take that competitive brawl that doesn't mean anything and is forgotten about and not emphasized by the end of the show that it's on. Derek, back to you. Anything else you want to say?
Nope, that's it. I enjoyed you guys' conversation, and you guys thanks for taking my call, and have a great night, great summer.
Great, thanks, Derek. Appreciate it. All right, our number, 347-215-8558. If you call us and you want to be on the show, push 1, as our caller from area code 314 did. 314, maybe St. Louis area. Go ahead, state your name and where you're calling from.
Hello, my name is Don. I'm from St. Louis. I was wondering what you guys think of the whole idea of the main event, and was it in between last year's barbed wire match and this year's barbed wire match? Do you think Tony Khan has killed the stipulation?
And why do you think that this match might have killed the stipulation? Elaborate on that.
Because of the constant run-ins and the like heel turns, like a lot going on, not really stipulation in a way, the silliness with the barbed wire mic.
Yeah. Yeah. When a barbed wire match isn't enough, Eric, and you've got a shark cage and women brawling at ringside and a turn among those women and a return of Sammy Guevara and baby faces running out, including your interim champion, all in a big brawl. And then you have a false finish and a botched finish and then an actual finish. And then after the finish, a post-match spot that is actually the story of the match because, you know, Eddie got revenge and he got blood. It does sort of feel like, wait a second, let's pull back all the stuff I just said for 25 seconds there. Can we just have a barbed wire match? Can't they just go one-on-one and settle it? And if you need a shark cage because it's shark week and you want to keep people from interfering, keep them locked up. Like, establish that the shark cage works. It's like if every Hell in a Cell match in WWE involved the cage being raised or the structure being penetrated and wrestlers brawling outside of it and on top of it, it's no longer a structure that keeps people inside. You have to have that baseline. So on a rare exception, every 6 times you do the match, it has more impact. What do you think, Eric?
AEW has not had great luck with barbed wire. There was that weird match from the first full gear in Baltimore in 2019. I thought that one was a little weird, that the barbed wire looked almost like cartoony.
Yeah.
Then there was the Moxley Kenny Omega exploding barbed wire match at the Revolution pay-per-view.
How'd that go?
Oh my God. I think that was one of the times I've been legitimately, one of the few times I've been legitimately mad at AEW since they started. And I look, stuff happens. The thing didn't explode. It looked really, really bad. But then they like tried to, they came up with some convoluted storyline to sell it. Like Kenny Omega did it on purpose. And I was just mad at them for insulting my intelligence like that.
Yep.
So the promotion does not have a great record with barbed wire. You could make the argument, does it really belong on American television in 2022? Or is it something that was like sort of, is it something that's sort of best left for IWA Mid-South and GCW and those kind of deathmatch promotions? You know, as somebody whose favorite period of wrestling, I really liked, you know, the start of the NWO era on Nitro, and I liked WWF Attitude era. So, I mean, like, to me, the heyday of wrestling, when it was a ton of fun, everything was overbooked, right? I mean, it was the era of overbooking and run-ins, and then Sting comes down from the rafters, and then there's three different turns. So I guess to me, you know,
imagine how much more successful and bigger pro wrestling would have been if that hadn't been part of that boom period. You could argue.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to me, I was higher on this match than you were just because it was fun, and I guess if it's your job, I bet if you did a poll, maybe you could put one up, the your average fan is probably going to say, oh, that was fun. And then they're going to click and move the channel to whatever's on in the 9 o'clock central hour, 10 o'clock Eastern hour on television. If it's your job to analyze pro wrestling, I don't dispute you had a lot of nits to pick. They gave you a lot of nits to pick. I mean, there was comedy, unintentional comedy in there, largely thanks to Ms. Conti. With her fists and her inability to open a padlock. So
well, and the Jericho chair shots and a point where Eddie Kingston seemed to be spinning the wrestlers around in a position for an elbow that he swung and missed on, and you're wondering, was that supposed to happen? Like, there were times I was watching that going, was that botched or was that supposed to happen? Because everybody was stutter stepping trying to get into the right position for an overly convoluted spot. So it's not just the booking. Well, I think the overbooking led to clumsy execution because they're making things more complicated than they needed to be. It's like, you know, it's like, hey, frosting on a cake. Wouldn't it be better if we put a cupcake on top of the cake, added more frosting, 3 scoops of ice cream, and then some toppings, and now let's pour chocolate syrup on top, and then a stack of chocolate chip cookies followed. It's like, no, like cake is good, and you put frosting on it, and people enjoy it. You don't need to add all this other stuff to it. And maybe that's what Don's getting at. I'll throw back to Don. It goes back to what I said, just a barbed wire match is enough and do a couple gory spots and then go to your finish and save the 7 other things that happened for the next couple weeks of television under other circumstances. Don, would you have enjoyed this more if it was stripped down? I mean, it's crazy to say it, but just a stripped down barbed wire match where it's just two wrestlers, barbed wire and blood.
Yeah. I feel like it needs to be more simple. I feel like AEW overly exaggerates sometimes when they really don't need to. Like, Blood and Guts were simple enough and it was well executed, but this was like the complete opposite of Blood and Guts. It was just like almost Vince Russo-esque in a way.
I think the question here is, so why is it overbooked like this, and why is it for those who didn't like it, you know, why is there all these needlessly complex things and layered upon layer, you know, a 7-layer dip of a match when a barbed wire match might have been enough? Why is it? Well, AEW prides itself on giving wrestlers creative freedom. We don't have people writing your promos. We don't have people scripting everything to within an inch of its life that turns off many to the modern WWE product. You know, but with great creative freedom comes great responsibility. And you could see three people who think as much about wrestling as Tony Khan, Eddie Kingston, and Chris Jericho do, and having these big rosters and both, you know, lots of guys on both sides here from these two factions. You could see where, well, what if we did this? Okay, and then what if we did this? And what if we did, you know, it's the stone soup sort of mentality. They keep throwing everything in, and then pretty soon it's bubbling over, and it depending on your point of view on this main event, was a mess, bubbled over into a mess or not, depending on your enjoyment of the match.
I don't think it's a meme, but it should be. When Bret Hart was guest was doing guest color commentary in, I don't know if it was during the Nitro era or not, but it was right, you know, whatever, right around that time. And he sat down next to Vince McMahon. Vince was on commentary at that point, I'm almost positive. And because he turned to, well, yeah, because he turned to Vince and he just, yeah, this had to be pre-Nitro. Well, anyway, who cares? So Brett's sitting next to Vince on commentary and he just looks over at Vince and goes, you just keep adding to the soup. And it was like, you know, because there was like a false finish and a run-in and then another run-in. And Brett broke character live on Raw and just made a comment he'd be saying if he was in Gorilla sitting next to Vince on headsets. You just keep adding to the soup, don't you? And that's what this felt like. And I someone could find that and turn that into a meme. It should be. If it isn't, then I'm not on social media enough to rule out that it isn't. But someone should find that and make it a meme because it will get used a lot on nights like this. Or a GIF. Maybe that's what I'm looking for, a GIF. It's more of a GIF than a meme, but it can work either way. Don, anything else you want to add?
Yes, I don't understand why Tony Khan always feels the need to bring somebody just coming off WWE TV to his, like only like a month, sooner or no later. Like, I don't feel like if somebody else could have been in the two dying spots tonight, maybe like Silver or Lee Moriarty, somebody who's lower on the card, but they haven't used really much on TV, even like a Nick Camarado or something like that.
And are you referring to, was it?
Cole Carter.
I was thinking Kyle Carter. Yeah, Cole Carter. It felt weird. Like it's worked out well with Matt Menard and not Angelo Dawkins, Parker. I think they've been great. They're like an example of people who become bigger stars in AEW than they were where they used to be, but they were practically jobbers in NXT. But they're, you know, mega talented and, you know, I don't know. I don't want to. There's a few people I could compare them to, but I think they are just kind of their own thing, and they're being utilized well. But it did seem weird that Tony signed them right away, and that worked. So I guess, you know, jury's out. I assume Tony or somebody else in AEW's brain trust got word that he was good and worth bringing in. And I thought he looked good in the ring. On the mic, he seemed like a green indie guy who was nervous, but that's fine because it fit the character he's playing. He's taking on, you know, an established veteran guy with a belt, although everybody has a belt in AEW almost. So I don't know. What do you think, Eric, about the idea of just as soon as somebody comes available, Tony's just like snatches them up and it feels like it's other than, you know, Bray Wyatt and Braun Strowman and I don't know who else, Enzo. Like there's not a lot of people who left WWE and haven't just been swooped up and signed right away.
Is it Don, the caller? Is that?
Yeah.
I didn't catch your name. I do not disagree with your broader point. I think it's very smart. I mean, you look at Tony Nese. Did AEW need to sign Tony Nese? I happened to be at the Dynamite in Chicago where Brian Kendrick was supposed to debut shortly after getting released.
Yeah.
And then we know what happened there. His past caught up to him, and that match was canceled. But, you know, they're the same point. Why bring in? I guess in this case, you just wanted somebody to do a job for Ricky Starks to rehabilitate him after he lost the tag team match title match last week. And Two Dimes might have had five or six week run on NXT before he, you know, 2 months maybe before he was summarily dismissed from WWE. And so I don't know that people probably, I don't know, much of the audience even know who the heck the guy was besides, you know, really, really hardcore wrestling fans who still watch the dregs that is NXT at this point. I will say it would have been nice. Cole Carter won a dark squash match at the tape, spoiler alert, at the tapings, the dark tapings in Orlando, the show that airs Tuesday nights, just regular dark, not Dark Elevation. It would have been nice if they aired that squash match last night so they could just point to video of him winning that match to just give like a fig leaf of you know, credibility against Ricky Starks. I guess in this case, whatever. Cole Carter's probably not going to rise above. I was a Chicago Cubs fan for all of my life until they traded all the good players away last year. And the Cubs just, you know, it's like a bottom feeding NHL or MLB or NFL team who just sees these free agents who've hit the waiver wire and picks them up, you know, gives them a paycheck, sees what they've got. Sometimes they stick, sometimes they don't. To your point, Don, it's more broadly, yeah, absolutely. Why does AEW do that?
Don, any closing words from you?
No, just I think it was a B-plus show tonight, and everything else was fine. And that promo was probably the best promo you ever see on television. Anyway, have a great summer, guys.
What? Which? I'm sorry, Don. Which promo?
The Dex promo. Dex Harwood.
Oh yeah, thank you. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, Eric, talk about what FDR said, and you know, Cash saying, you know, it's going to take them a while to get used to that kind of response, and then it took fans a while to get organized for the FDR chant, which is kind of funny. It's like that seemed the obvious thing to do, but they got it together and chanted that. And then Dax just, you know, bringing that, you know, I talk about Bianca Belair feeling like, you know, it's just she's programmed and they're just pushing buttons and then she says things that are her signature phrases. And there's this actual human being who's mega marketable that, you know, that feels more authentic and spontaneous when you see her outside of WWE TV. And not everybody has that gift of charisma when she's just being natural that Bianca does. And WWE is just losing it by programming her the same way they do other people who aren't as naturally charismatic and need that assistance. And Dax is an example. I'm comparing Dax and Bianca Belair right now, but Dax is a guy where, you know, you just, when you let him just kind of talk from the heart, he's just such a big wrestling fan. He's such a family guy. He's so dedicated to his craft. He wants to be great. And he's doing so without the obvious cosmetic advantages that so many people have in wrestling, whether it's an Omos type or an Austin Theory type. And it's just one of those nights where I just think fans are like, I'm going to go pay money and cheer that guy.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it suddenly got, as a parent, it suddenly got dusty, and it'll be dusty roads. Yeah. In my living room when I was watching Dax's promo and talking about his daughter, but I'm not saying it didn't get dusty either at my house. Yeah, I mean, it's a great promo. You know, the downside of that is the Briscoes, because of their previous choices on social media 10 years ago. I understand why they're not welcome on television due to the higher ups at Warner Brothers Discovery. And so, you know, what would have been great to lend some heat to that match. You know, I know they shot an angle or whatever that aired on Dark or social media or both or whatever, but you know, I mean, ideally in that situation, the Briscoes come out and say, what an emotional problem. And, you know, they get heat off making fun of his daughter, right? You know, known as the Christian Cage principle on AEW Dynamite lately. And, you know, they couldn't do that. And so, you know, the FTR Briscoes match was a notebook match, right? Match of the year contender, certainly on American television and pay-per-view. And it, you know, so yes, FTR great. Loving the FTR on this run. Both the work rate and their surprising connection to the fans, despite, you know, sort of being natural heels, I think, you know, it would be like if and when the Midnight Express turned face in the 80s, which they sort of did for a brief period when they were going to feud with the Horsemen, but I think that they might have left NWA, WCW, Cracker Promotions before that happened to go become the Brainbusters in WWE, if I'm remembering that right. You know, like Bobby Eaton was never going to be able to talk that well. That's why you had Cornette there. But Stan Lane might have been able to. We never got to see that. But we're getting to see sort of the modern Midnight Express tribute act and FTR try and pull this off. More broadly, you know, mostly this show was a lot about promoting this Ring of Honor pay-per-view. And I just remain not into that at all. The end of Ring of Honor was bad and boring and lacked star power. And just was not my thing. Couldn't watch the weekly TV anymore. I'll be really glad when this pay-per-view is in the rearview mirror and they still got 6 Rampages before All Out to set up that card. I really, you know, the promotion has felt a little bit stuck in neutral since the fantastic Forbidden Door pay-per-view that I was fortunate enough to see live. And I think, you know, I understand why they put, you know, thought it was worth promoting. Tony Khan is insistent on continuing this ROH brand. You know, and there are many drawbacks to that pro wrestling torch contributors have ably outlined, so I won't get into them, but I'll be glad to turn the page next week, hopefully.
All right, very good. Let's go next to Bryant in Boston. Bryant, what stood out on Dynamite for you tonight?
This show was not great. It started off strong with Darby Allin and Brody King. Pretty good hard-hitting match, although I fear a little bit for Darby's safety when he puts some of those spots. But really good hard-hitting match to start off the show, and a nice little angle with Sting, Malakai, and kind of Rusev in the equation afterwards. So show got off to a promising start, but after that, it kind of went downhill. I ragged on this last week with the best friends. I don't know why they're on television. Like, the crowd reaction of them wasn't as strong as it has been in the past. And quite frankly, I mean, like, I understand the value of keeping, you know, Trent Beretta around. He was sort of like a gatekeeper type guy, knows how to work and things like that. But Chuck Taylor is not good. That match went way too long and was a lot more competitive than it should have been. It's the Black Bull Combat Club. They beat the crap out of people, and this was like a neutered version of the Blackpool Combat Club. I just think, you know, pile drivers in a row on Wheeler Yuta and then kicking out of it. I mean, never mind the fact that that's dangerous for the guy's health to do that. The match should have been like 5 minutes and should have been Moxley and Yuta stomping their ass and beating them. For the most part, that match should not have been competitive. So I'm just wondering what you guys' thoughts were on that. I just think the best friends should not be on TV. They're a joke to me.
I agree with your broader point that the show was not great. If you stack this would be in the bottom tier of all the Dynamites we've seen over only 3 years.
Yeah,
totally agree. I like the main event more than most, so I can go B minus, but I could see where people would have it in the C range. As far as the best friends, I mean, they had a great feud against Santana and Ortiz that was well received. I wouldn't ban them from TV. They're fine in a gatekeeper role, and they're mostly, you know, Trent and Chuck are there to be support for Orange Cassidy, who they did make a star to a varying degree, despite what initially would have seemed as a limiting gimmick.
I don't think he needs him.
But you are correct in that. Good Lord, with this, the Heat just segment where they were beating on Wheeler Yuta just went on and on.
Yeah.
Was Moxley ever in the match? I couldn't even tell if Moxley was
long.
In the match. Not very much if he was.
More than
way
Christian.
Too, yeah. way too, and the, were those in back-to-back? Those were back-to-back matches, right? Again, the quality control problem. They need someone overseeing. Hey, maybe let's not do – well, I guess the second one, the Luchasaurus thing, was a squash, mostly to set up Jungle Boy.
And I mean, in fairness, in the 12-minute match with the conversion break, Mox got a hot tag after the break and was pretty involved in the second half. And it was the pre-break beatdown of Yuta that, you know, went on for a while. And part of the reason that's worthy of criticism is is it a face versus face matchup, or is Trent Beretta's attitude about Wheeler Yuta meant to make him a heel? And Chuck Taylor's got a little bit more of an edge to him. He doesn't walk around like he's, you know, at a kid's birthday party trying to entertain people, or goofing off with his friends in the dorm. Like, he had a little bit of an edge and a serious tone, and he's a little more facial hair or whatever. If they're heels, like, just turn them heel. Brian, what were you saying?
Yeah.
Sorry, Eric.
I just don't think anyone cares about the best friends anymore. I really don't. And I mean, Orange Cassidy, okay, yeah, the guy's got something there. But personally, I don't think Cassidy really needs anyone anymore. I mean, his demeanor. He's a great wrestler, and his demeanor can sustain itself. He doesn't need the two chuckle bunnies porting him anymore. He's fine on his own.
Virtually everybody in AEW, it's like the New Japan style. Virtually everybody in New Japan is in a faction. Virtually everybody in AEW is in a faction, right? And they do that so that they can have sacrificial lambs do the job,
yep.
Just like in all those endless New Japan 6-man, 8-man tags you see. This, I think Wade is right in that the psychology was off because the Best Friends, yep. In theory, are a face act, at least Orange Cassidy is. The faces in a tag team match, the traditional psychology is that the heels do the beat down. And so you had faces definitely for sure playing the heels in this match. And the backstory was Trent bullied Wheeler Yuta, which walking to the ring, a montage sizzle reel of all the times Trent bullied Yuta when he was in Best Friends might have helped sell this. I mean, Yuta was gone for the longest time because he was in the New Japan Junior Tournament. And, I guess he was back for Blood and Guts, but, you know, needed to be reestablished. And I guess the point of the match was, you know, we need to get Wheeler Yuta over, you know, before his pay-per-view match. And he did by getting the win and kicking, as you said, pointed out, kicking out of two pile drivers somehow, which probably should be
dangerous.
One pile driver, okay. Two, come on now. And then the other problem with Yuta is his finisher is weak. Like everybody else in the BCC has these ass kicking submission hold finishers and they're just brutal. And you know he's got like a roll up like Orange Cassidy. It's not super strong stuff. But whatever. I mean, you know, the point at the end of the day was to get Wheeler Yuta over heading into the pay-per-view. And did they do that? I mean, I guess. I don't really care about it, so maybe not. Maybe it didn't work. Certainly, that was the reason he got the pin.
It felt like, you know, it was like, just decide. Is Trent Beretta wrong for the way he treated Wheeler Yuta, or is he right for feeling like Yuta abandoned him? And it's like, it shouldn't be played as like both sidesism by the announcers. It's like, just give us the strong declarative emotional case that Trent was a jerk and Wheeler Yuta left for good reasons. And he's in a group that he bonds with more, and have Beretta and Chuck be heels and let fans just lean in on letting fans boo them and have them lean in on being heels. And it's sort of this, no, we're going to be more artfully nuanced. And it's not about heels and faces or it's contextual. And they are just, you know, depends on who they're against. And it's like, you just end up not with strong emotions either way, other than, you know, thinking they get too much TV time. And I know Tony thinks the world of Trent and Chuck. And I think he thinks too much of them to be honest. I mean, Chuck's ring work is just, you know, not for national TV.
Turning them heel would be inconvenient because next week or 2 weeks from now they might be feuding with true heels, right? And so
yeah,
big pain in the ass to do the turn. Yeah, so I mean, it's the shading of, you know, in a face-versus-face match, who's going to work the heel style, and that was Best Friends. It's just, as both of you have ably pointed out, the Trent and Chuck as a tag team are probably past their sell-by date.
All right, Brent, anything else before we move on?
The Starks promo in Danhausen was pretty funny. I actually kind of enjoyed that with the invitation. But
yeah.
just two quick little things, and I'll be fast. Swerve and Keith Lee, that segment was stupid. I mean, the promo was good enough as it was, but you got to use that segment to build up their next challengers. I'm tempted to drop an F-bomb right now, but I'm not going to. You don't need Mark Sterling and Tony Nese out there. And no one cares about the rapper. No one does, really. That segment was so unnecessary. They should have just, after the promo was done, they should have just had, like, some, maybe the Bucks come out or something and say a rematch or something, or maybe, you know, you tease FTR for that later on. But that was terrible. That had no business being on TV. And then the last thing I wanted to was the women's tag match. why in the hell was Willow Nightingale in that match and not Chris Statlander? I mean, was there some reasoning for that? No one.
Yes.
I don't want to speak ill of wrestlers, but no one cares about Willow Nightingale, and her offense wasn't terribly good either. Chris Statlander's over with the crowd. Granted, she's, you know, they shouldn't let her talk as much, or, you know, give her a little bit of more promo work. But Statlander, it should have been Statlander and Athena versus Hogan and Cargill. That match would have gone a lot more smoothly. It would have been better. And Tony Khan just puzzled me with booking sometimes. He's got to get somebody who can kind of set him straight a little bit. I'm just going to say this overall, this show, it sucked. There were some good parts, but like I give it like a 4 out of 10, maybe a 5 if I'm feeling generous. Anyway, I'll hang up and listen if you guys have any more thoughts on what I just said. Anyway, have a good night.
Sure. Yeah. Go ahead, Eric.
So I thought about this too. I'm like, why, I assume Layla Gray was unable to perform for some reason, or there was a planned change, right? Why does, you know, I'm like, well, why does Stokely Hathaway get to decide what the match is? He's, you know, I know there's no authority figure, and thank God for that, but that seemed weird to me. But then I realized, oh, Jade can't lose, right? Her winning streak has to continue.
Yeah.
So they're building up both Athena and Statlander for Jade challenges, and they could not afford to have Athena take a pin or Statlander take a pin. So we got awkward Willow Nightingale, who's got a lot of charisma and fire, but the work rate just isn't there yet. Sorry. So that's that. I thought that the match was rough as well in spots. A lot of energy seemed to have, you know, a little bit of crowd heat behind him. Crowd was into it a little bit. I did not like the Swerve Keith Lee segment either, because Swerve's whole speech was about putting over a rap artist, which I guess in hindsight was because the rap artist was going to get involved physically and Mark Sterling was going to, you know, take a cake to the face. But Mark Sterling and Tony Nese come out, and Tony Nese is not rehabbed from his NXT and the 205 Live stint he had, where he was a job guy in WWE. And, you know, no one believes that there's this goofy petition to remove Swerve. It's all lame.
Yeah.
The segment seemed, as Bryant noted, segment seemed designed to get over Kevin Gates, the rapper, instead of the new tag champs, right? Yeah. Was not exactly a momentum builder for Swerve and Keith Lee. Does not set up the next opponent. That was a problem. Very WWE-like with the comedy heel manager. And the tag champs were an afterthought, were in the ring and were an afterthought. I guess Swerve got to do the cake. But, I fully expected their next challenger to come out. It didn't happen, and it was just lame. Now, all of that said, representation matters. And I saw at least one prominent black wrestling Twitter guy, Phil Lindsay, I think, said this is the blackest Dynamite that there's ever been, right? So you had the Swerve segment, the rap dude. You had, you know, Ricky Starks was on there, and then you had the tag team match where four of the four competitors were Statlander was not in the match. Four of the four competitors were black African American, and so
and Gresham on the video package.
Yeah, to that extent, I mean, we shouldn't overlook that, you know, representation does matter, and it is important to appeal to audiences. And AEW maybe super served. Some would argue that AEW has a little bit of ground to make up in this regard. And so, you know, to find a silver lining there, to Brian's point.
Yes, but don't put them out there to represent and have the material be as unsupervised or as poorly scripted or whatever in between it was.
For sure.
Because, I mean, Keith Lee going, oh, I'm getting hot under here, I'm going to take my jacket off. And then Swerve going, starting a striptease chant of take it off, Keith, take it off. Well, Taz is like, keep it on, Keith, keep it on. It was funny, but in sort of that embarrassing way, like you're uncomfortable for the performers. The inside joke of, hey, your album's out, but when's the deluxe version coming out? Oh, in a little bit. All right. It felt like that was a text between them. That didn't belong on national television. And it just seemed like somebody hijacked Tony Khan's TV that he's so preciously worried about the minute for minutes in order to promote a rap album and then do a cornball cake in the face angle that's supposed to be self-aware and ironic, but just came across as a poor use of TV time. I mean, decide who Keith Lee and Swerve are going to be, but if they're just going to be, I'm going to put my friends over and awkwardly talk about Keith taking off his clothes. I don't know. It's just, you know, go out there and be cool. And Keith Lee can talk about the fans booing their, like, the fans support being vital to what his journey has been. And, you know, not everybody can do what Dax did tonight, but Keith can talk, you know, about, hopefully he can be introspective and honest enough about what's gone on in his career and have fans kind of be on the edge of their seat, hanging on his every word because he's getting real with us. And instead it's the generic fans. We are successful because of you. And now we're going to do a weird angle with Mark Sterling with cake and a rap artist that just feels random. It felt like an inside joke and unself-aware and trying to be cool, but not pulling it off. And it wasn't good. It wasn't a good start for them as a team to establish who they are and what their identity is.
Yeah, representation matters. So does giving all your performers A material to work with instead of C-minus material. And, you know, I don't know how much of that is the whole show is Dynamite since Forbidden Door has just been sort of stuck in neutral again. And, you know, ROH pay-per-view will be in the rearview mirror. And they got 6 weeks to figure it out, to figure out who Swerve and Lee will be facing at All Out.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to Ryan in Cumberland, Maryland next. And we got Javier standing by too. So everybody stay tuned for the roundtable with Javier and some mailbags. Ryan, welcome. What'd you think of Dynamite tonight?
It was a fine show. I have a question on Sting. Do you think he may turn heel since he got the mist in the face, or at least a personality change to a darker type personality, since everyone else seems to be impacted by this mist of black?
Hadn't thought of that. Eric, have you? Eric, are you there? I'm hearing some clicking. Eric is adjusting or plugging in his mic or something.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you, but we can also hear all the background noise. So it's like you went to speaker or something.
Yeah, apologies. My headphones seem to have given up the ghost. So I'll put myself on mute and listen to you guys for a little bit.
Well, no. Go ahead. What do you think about – it's fine. What do you think about –
I didn't hear what he said, so
– Oh, he said it's Sting turning heel because he got the dark mist, and the dark mist in the face turns people darker, the personality-wise.
It feels like they sort of have abandoned that maybe a little bit. Like,
yeah.
It didn't happen to Miro, at least. I don't think the fans want to boo 60-something-year-old legend Sting, who puts his body on the line, perhaps foolishly – on Dynamite and at pay-per-view. I don't think heel Sting would get over.
Yeah, my thing, Ryan, is they set up a six-man tag, and I think they're heading that way. I think Darby and Sting, yeah, especially with what they did with Luchasaurus and Christian, I don't think going the route of breaking up a tag team with somebody unlikely going heel, it makes sense at this point. Sting might creatively be up for that, but I don't think at this stage of his career this should be about Sting doing something that's creatively exciting for him. I mean, Sting should be who Sting is at this point and ride that. What else, Ryan?
Same question is on Cole Carter. They announced him from Charleston, West Virginia. There's a show coming up in about a month, the Dynamite tapings, that's be from that city. Since that's such a small city, do you think Cole will get a spot on that show, since he could really get over in that town since everyone knows who he is there?
I think it's overrated and sometimes a bad idea to talk about a wrestler being in their hometown. Like, I don't care. I mean, like, I just don't think it is relevant. Like, I don't want to watch a TV show and have them draw attention on like some drama series to like, hey, we're filming in their hometown this scene. If it doesn't fit the plot, like, I don't know. I mean, there's times to do it for sure. But like, I mean, it's always going to be with the size of AEW's roster, and almost every week somebody's going to be in their hometown. I just don't think that is a storyline point worth bringing up, and I certainly don't think you should book around it, especially if it isn't someone you would be pushing anyway. Eric, any disagreement there?
No.
All right. And Ryan, what else, if anything?
The other question I have is on these pile drivers that were used for in the first and second match. You know, the reason why AEW does so many pile drivers, I like the pile driver, but it's sort of overdo it, is because there would be bands move, and you know, it makes them feel a little bit special that they can do the move in a match.
I know Steve Austin, you know, 6-7 years ago was upset that a DDT had become a transition move, like a vertical suplex. There's a risk of sound, you know, of trying to wind back the clock on something that is too far down the road in terms of being seen as a transition move. But to me, you kick out of a pile driver on a pay-per-view main event, you know, twice a year to add drama, and the other 50 weeks out of the year, a pile driver ends a match. I just think you start numbing people to moves if being dropped on your skull and compressing your neck is something that you kick out of, because in a WrestleMania main event, Triple H and Undertaker kicked out of a bunch of finishers and you thought that was great. There's so many things in AEW that wrestlers are allowed to do that it's like a bunch of short stories stapled, you know, put together in some anthology of a book. And it's like there's no rhyme or reason or sense of collective cadence to everything. And that's something WWE is a lot better at. You know, Brian Gewirtz, it's embargoed, but Brian Gewirtz writes about it in his book coming up. You know, and it's something that WWE is very conscious of, and AEW doesn't seem very conscious of, is, you know, what happens in this match sometimes shouldn't happen based on what's happening later on the pay-per-view or later on the TV show or later in the month or later in the year. And pile drivers is a symbolic example of that. Eric, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, a couple. One, I think this topic came up on the Fix mailbag or on the Fix in recent weeks. And Todd talked about how this very thing, how the DDT is now a transition move, and that's a natural evolution. And, you know, new moves get created, old moves move down the pecking order and are just to set up a finisher, and that's a natural progression of things. And then, you know, DDTs and pile drivers could come back as finishers in the future, which I think is an interesting point. I think the pile driver does, you know, I enjoy the pile driver. The thing that cemented my wrestling fandom as a young teen, early teen, was Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff turning on Hulk Hogan and hitting him with the pile driver, right? I went nuts for that because it was the first big friendship turn angle I'd seen in wrestling, and I was hooked ever since. So I have a soft spot for pile drivers. Wheeler Yuta tonight kicked out of two pile drivers, which seems excessive. Kicking out of one pile driver does not seem out of the ordinary in 2022, but two seems a little goofy. But, you know, I mean, the Undertaker, you know, there are various forms of pile drivers. The old school, the guy doing the move falls backwards thing, and hopefully if he's competent, has the guy's head between his legs and off the mat so he doesn't actually hit his head on the mat. That pile driver would not be seen as a finisher in 2022. The Undertaker's, you know, tombstone pile driver protected to the end, right? You know, Okada in New Japan does, does he do a version of the tombstone, I think, that he turns the guy around like a spinning tombstone? That's not his finisher, right? That's used to set up the Rainmaker. So, yay, pile drivers.
Yeah, I just say, just because something is being done doesn't mean you resign yourself to not being able to correct course or pull back a little bit on it. And the star who does it and the context in which it's a setup move to a finish versus a transition move with several minutes more to go in the match are all pertinent details that I don't think are being filtered through Tony Khan's philosophy at this point on how to approach things. I think it's sort of a free for all, the more crowd pops and high spots and the better. As opposed to, is this a move we want to protect? And if we're going to not protect it, under what circumstances is it okay and not okay to do it? And I think a little more attention to detail on that, rather than resigning yourself to the examples of there being a lack of thought put into it for years now, and resigning herself to just sort of giving up and just using it the way you use a vertical suplex or a clothesline now. I just don't think you have to be resigned to that.
You can't go back, Wade.
Oh, I totally disagree. I mean, I think it would be
the subtitle of your autobiography, and I'm sorry, that's an unfair shot, but you know, I think often a theme I've noticed in your criticism and how you think about things, a lot of it's useful and would build heat and build emotion behind storylines and feuds, but some of it, like movesets, I mean, those do constantly evolve, right? And that the pile driver is just the straight pile driver, the sit your butt back down type is just viewed as like an 80s thing, right? It's antiquated. When you have, you know, you can make the argument guys don't sell stuff enough today, and you're right, generally speaking, they don't, especially in AEW, but I don't see wrestling ever going back to the sit on your butt pile driver being, you know, this big bad finisher, or the DDT for that matter.
Yeah. So unfair oversimplification of the point that I'm making, and I'm pretty selective in terms of what I think is timeless and try to articulate what I think has lost its way and needs to just be brought back into focus about how something timelessly works versus how it's being poorly utilized now. And I think there's examples of things that in WWE where a lot of thought is put into some of this stuff and it pays dividends because there's actual, you know, moves that are protected and work. And then there's just other moves that aren't done excessively that chip away at other moves that don't look as devastating, but are that signature spot. I think Ryan, that probably is all your points.
Yeah, the only other thing I have to say is, have you seen that Chris Jericho barbed wire match that he was talking about from like 30 years ago? I was just wondering if he digressed on that match since he started wrestling.
What do you mean if he digressed on the match?
As far as, match quality, like he was better at that match when he first started compared to 2020.
He probably got better and now he got worse. You know, I don't think this is a match he's going to like volunteer to put on his best of, DVD because, DVDs are great, Eric, and we should go back to those. I don't think he's going to be putting this on his best of DVD compilation or, writing about it as a high point in his career. But I also don't think that it's fair to say like that having a bad or a flawed execution of a barbed wire match means that he's only gotten worse over time and he started out, better. I don't know. I feel like that's and setting things up sort of unfairly as far as Jericho goes, because he's had highs and lows his entire career. I think there's things he was overrated for during his prime, and I think there's things that he's been underrated for in some circles in recent years. He's had a very good career. This tonight was not, top level work from him. Ryan, appreciate the call as always.
Thanks for taking the call.
Yep, you bet. All right, we're just talking about that barbed wire match. I want to bring Javier up on next after I read a quick email about the barbed wire match that Ryan just brought up. Joe from New York says, the fact is this main event match was a total waste of airtime. This will not help AEW grow their ratings. If this is all Jericho can do at age 50 or 51, it's time for him to hang it up. I don't want to see an ECW-style 1996 main event. Tony Khan has no idea what people want, and he's giving us crap like that by giving us crap like that in the main event. Also, did I hear correct? AEW is going to do a wrap-off? What the hell? Kurt Hennig, a.k.a. Mr. Perfect, said it years ago. WCW rap is crap. Who the hell wants to see that, and who thinks that's going to draw ratings? Final point. Tony Khan's making mistake after mistake. He bought ROH without a real plan for it. He has no TV for it. Plus, he has too many titles on his shows, which make no one or nothing feel important. Tony Khan, the fact is people want serious adult product that makes sense. ECW 1996 barbed wire matches is not what wrestling fans want. So anyway, I would say you can have a barbed wire match and do it better, and it would be just fine. And maybe it'd be exactly what a lot of fans want. I think it's more about the execution of the concept than the concept. As for the wrap-off, don't underrate Austin. He's going to be good unless he intentionally tanks. He's done some raps at Max Caster, live rap shows. I saw one and in person, and I felt like they've been wanting to do this for a while, and it's going to happen on Rampage. I mean, who knows if it's going to be good or not, but Austin Gunn is going to be prepared to be really good if that's what this angle calls for. Eric, your thoughts on that?
On the main event, look, the top stars are injured, a lot of them. Tony Khan's dealing with a lack of star power at the top this summer. He's made the potentially ill-fated decision to push an ROH pay-per-view for much of the month of July. And this Dynamite was just a get-through-it Dynamite. Most of the matches, you knew who was going to win. They didn't really give a lot away. Kingston, Jericho, your mileage may vary. It was at least a logical continuation of a long-running, months-long feud between these two factions. So as for the wrap-off, oh boy, I am not looking forward to that on Rampage, and it's for the very reason you cited. I, too, was at the same wrap show after Full Gear in Minneapolis that you were at, Wade. And I may never forgive you for that one. You went in the VIP area, mingling with the AEW roster who was there to build sources. And I drank middling beer while listening to bad rap songs by Max Caster in Austin Gunn doing a heartfelt white boy rap attempt. His raps were sort of emotional and soulful. The problem is, it's Billy Gunn's kid, so I didn't buy it even for half of a second. And good Lord, that night never ended. And I'm glad that I went, if only because I have this story to tell right now on this AEW Dynamite post show about the great time Wade Keller had and the never-ending evening that I had watching bad rappers.
All right, very good. Eric, when you are talking, we're hearing clicking noises. I'm not sure why, but I think we're at a point where it would be better for you to call into the switchboard and I can bring you on. I think that might sound better than whatever has happened to your headset.
Yeah, you're on a laptop speaker right now. So
yeah, and that's fine. It's that there's constant click, 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 click when you talk, and I'm not quite sure what to attribute that to, but it's kind of unsustainable for.
Okay. Yep. Got it. I will hang up and call in.
Cool. Sounds good. All right. So let's see. What did I say is coming up next? Oh yeah. Javier, PW Torch VIP podcaster and contributor. Javier, welcome. I feel kind of bad because I hung up on Eric hung up on us, and I'm still hearing some of the clicking. So it wasn't necessarily his setup, even though it seemed to start when his system went down. But anyway, Javier, welcome.
Well, if it adds anything, I don't hear clicking on my end. So.
Oh well, that's good. Yeah, then I'm happy about that. I won't have to worry about Fred over post production of the show then. It's just something coming through on my side of things here. But nevertheless, I think Eric will sound better when he chimes in. So Javier, welcome. You've heard what we've had to say. What do you want to bring up about the show?
I mean, I'll echo what some people said about the main event that, I went into it. I mean, I DM'd you before the thing started saying that I'm wearing my whites because I was trying to get myself in the mood. Considering the fact there have been a lot of these violent matches among, in this, between these groups for a while, so I'm like, okay, I want to get into the groove of this. I joked I was wearing my whites. So I was, looking forward to it. And it was good up until, granted, I was watching from halfway across the room, so I kind of missed the botchy spots. But it was good until all the craziness and, the overbooked stuff. And I'm like, I thought this problem would have been resolved with when Cody left, and I was having those the feel for it. And, you know, the whole everybody getting out of the shark cage and all that stuff going on. And then there's the whole thing that, you know, I was really hoping this is the end of this feud because it's been going on forever. Hopefully it is, because since it was a pyrrhic victory for Eddie Kingston, where he lost the match, but, you know, ended up getting the blood. Because on the was it Blood and Guts, he got the victory but not the blood. So, you know, now he has one victory and the blood. So I'm hoping he moves on. Maybe he'll start feuding with directly with Sammy Guevara instead of feuding with Jericho. Hopefully they move on. But, you know, I don't want this to continue. it's been a while. And it's beginning to feel like their feuds tend to run for, particularly when Jericho's involved, just overstay their welcome by like one or two events.
I agree. Eric, you're back with us, right?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yep, we sure can. Anything you want to add to what Javier said? Just the length
I
of
just
the
want
Jericho
to applaud. I want to applaud his gratuitous shot at Cody Rhodes. That's really good stuff, Javier. And to say, I was there at the Thanksgiving Eve Dynamite Rampage taping in Chicago at Wintrust downtown when this Jericho-Kingston dynamic began. So that's how long this has been going on. November, late November.
Wow, yeah. All right, Javier, what else?
Yeah, the one mentioned Derek brought up the whole Darby Allin thing. I understand some people, you know, some people are like, oh well, you know, how is he going to be in the future? But the thing is, Darby's crazy. On his days off, he jumps off buildings. So if he's not, you know, if he's not doing it in the ring, he's going to be doing it somewhere else. You know, there are videos of him getting hit by a car just for lulz.
This is not a perfect comparison, but I will bring it up anyway. Just because somebody is shooting up heroin in their private lives without cameras on them doesn't mean you bring them onto your TV show and say, well, they'd be shooting up heroin anyway, so we're going to film it for you to watch. I know it's not a great, you know, a perfect comparison, but there's something to it. That says if a guy's doing it for fun and you decide it's not good for him at all, but let's exploit it by making money off of it and we'll pay him so it seems fair. There might be some culpability there, I'm not even of the belief that it enters that territory most of the time with Darby. There's, you know, a couple times I've thought, I would have said no to that. But I do think he is, to your point, Javier, basically a trained stuntman at this point. And he's, you know, I think there's, again, with some exceptions that I've gasped at, I think a better judge than some give him credit for in terms of having putting thought and being rational about the chances that he takes and how he takes them. With the idea being he wants the reaction we're having to them. Yeah.
I have confidence that he knows I have confidence he knows how physics works. You know, which is something I didn't with the Hardys, because the Hardys have two bumps that were like, do they not know how physics works? One of them was, I think, either the first or the second TLC. Might have been the first, where Jeff ties a ladder to the corner and climbs up to the top of the ladder to do the swanton, and he pushes off against it, not knowing that it was going to bend away from him. So he just drops straight down. And, you know, that was, you know, wow. And the other one was the recent one with Matt, who did not calculate the parabolic arc of jumping off a scissor lift to land on the tables. Mm-hmm. And so he overshot all the tables. So, you know, at least Darby so far seems like his math is intact. So, you know, the stuff, you know, I mean, sometimes things go awry anyway, but I have more confidence in him. So, but yeah, I mean, I like the fact you brought glorified stuntman, because that's pretty much like perfectly what describes him.
And I think, you know, tonight is an example of, I think, it working well. Maybe it should have been, you know, 3-4 weeks ago building up to, or the Moxley Brody match should have been a couple weeks from now. You know, we can make a case for the order of things and such. But this was a compelling beating that he took that led to an angle afterwards to build up a match where there's going to be a mix of different kinds of talent. And I think the story with Darby is he's not a world title contender as a singles guy, but with the right team or under the right circumstances with the right opponent, you know, his style works, but it doesn't work all the time against everybody one-on-one. But you put him in a tag team situation, and he is this key X factor that can throw any game plan off, and his offense and his ability to take a beating can be a factor in a team winning. And there's a way to make what he does work, but you know, it can get gratuitous, and you don't want to ever make it seem like it's just a freak show. And that's a zone that I think you want to be cognizant of if you're Darby and Tony Khan. Eric, anything you want to add?
I mean, I'm sure at his size and stature, Darby Allin thinks this is the only way I can get over is by doing this. I think he's selling himself short, if that's how he thinks. But he's a creative, artistic type with an interesting, cool gimmick that caught on with young fans, right? You see, I don't know if you still do, but in addition to seeing little kids dressed up as Orange Cassidy, you'd see little kids painting half their faces to the extent that there are any little kids at Dynamite, which is mostly a male crowd, adult male crowd. Yeah, I mean, I guess it's the question of being the bump police, right? You know, in New Japan, you see Naito and Kota Ibushi, you know, killing each other's necks, and there's a segment of the fandom that cringes and poo-poos them and scolds them and wish they didn't do it, and then there's the segment that thinks these kind of things shouldn't be policed and they're adults. And so as someone who, you know, winced at every unprotected chair shot in WWE and WCW in the 90s, I tend to be more in the, gosh, I wish these guys wouldn't do this to themselves camp.
Yeah. All right, Javier.
Yeah, and then I'm glad that they finally doing something with Miro now that he's back. He did talk last week about – they didn't talk about the miss this week, but they did talk about it. He talked about it in the promo last week, or I think it was last week, where he did talk about that, you know, he still feels the miss inside of him. And he did cut a promo saying that, you know, talking to God saying, you know, did you put the House of Black in my way as my enemies or for me to join? So they kind of left that up in the air. And basically when it comes to the mist, there are three types of mist: green, red, and black. And black tends to be the darkest, the strongest one. I think there was a wrestler who was, you know, supposedly blinded for life. Because of black mist, and also has like corrupting properties, so that's probably how they explain Julia Hart turning to the dark side. So it's a possibility they might do something with Sting, where he might get, you know, more darker and do a storyline where he has to like fight off the darkness kind of thing. Maybe that's what they're doing with Miro.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, there's some stuff depending on. I don't think, you know, so far they haven't shown a tendency to go full on. Supernatural. So, you know, one of those where they'll leave it up to the viewer's imagination whether there's maybe a supernatural component or not. I don't think they're going to go, like, all the way in.
Yeah. Well, Ryan feels a little vindicated with his idea, and you've added some nuance and intrigue to maybe them going that direction, Javier.
Who knew there was such lore around Myst? I applaud Javier's deep knowledge of Myst lore. I hope
that's why he has
not
a jingle,
Sting.
Eric.
Yes.
Well, it's Great Muta. I mean, if you were a fan of Great Muta, you know all about Myst. He would bring out the red Myst whenever he was in a blood feud. Because that was the more painful one. So there'd be matches where he would miss his opponent and not lead to the finish, and then he would use the red miss to finish him. So
that feels like sometimes when I drive my kids to school, I wear a seatbelt that works pretty well, but other times arbitrarily I decide I'm going to wear a seatbelt that really works well. Like, why not just bring the miss that's deadly all the time? Like, what's I don't get. The degree.
Well,
I guess
it's
honorable, you know,
right? Here's the thing, because this is the thing that actually comes up often, and
And one thing that I kind of don't like with some of the rest of some of the moves that faces use, where our moves, like for example, Tanahashi is a perfect example. The dragon whip leg screw is one of my favorite moves. I hate it when faces use it because the way that you're wrenching on the leg, you're injuring the leg. You're tearing at ligaments. You're doing damage. I always felt that baby faces should work to knock out the opponent or put him in a position to submit, but not to actually do like permanent damage to the other person to remove them from the equation. So, and only push that far when they absolutely need to. But yeah, that's one of the, you know, that's just, you know, my kind of like my personal philosophy on stuff like that.
All right. I can't believe I'm getting in the weeds on Mist with Javier here, but has Malakai Black used anything but Black Mist since debuting in AEW last summer?
No, because he's just pure evil.
Okay. All right. What's clarity? Like, for the record, I hope they don't do a Sting heel turn or flirt with a heel turn, because I'm still scarred from Sting in the rafters for way too many weeks, closing Nitro every week, and then was there a heel turn with Sting, and then he was a face, and then they cut him off, and he never really got over the way he should have. Like, I'm still scarred from that. Prefer to not go back to that, please and thank you.
Eric, have you gone back to watch Sting as the Joker in TNA?
I have probably watched 5 episodes of TNA in my life. It was at the time I was raising a family.
Yeah, well, go hunt down some Sting as the Joker and get back to us what you thought. Sting enjoyed expanding his character and his acting chops during that era.
I'm sorry. It sounded like you said Sting has acting chops.
Well, that's why I want you to go. I want you to go watch and report back. Javier, do you look fondly on Sting, Joker, TNA, Dixie Carter era?
That would have overlapped the time I stopped watching wrestling. I think I might have seen I might have seen just the beginning of that. And you know, just like he, you know, the first time, like I think it might have been like his first appearance in that style, and I was like, oh, this is an interesting take, but I didn't have time to actually learn about that. That might have been it for me.
See, this is one of those things where I'm going to be like wondering if I'm going to get an email from you in 3 days or 3 weeks, going, well, I did the deep dive on Joker Sting, and here's what I think, Wade.
Wade, would me watching Joker Sting, would it make me more upset than being at the wrap off between the rap concert with Austin Gunn and Max Caster? Was the Sting Joker turn better than the rap concert with Max Caster?
I am not going to predispose you to think one way or the other. just going with an open mind.
I think what killed it for me was I think it stopped around the time AJ was like they moved him to the top, and then I think they gave him a girlfriend or something. I don't remember something along that those road. That's pretty much where I'm like, okay, I'm done. But speaking of moves that don't, Erica, you were talking about Okada's tombstone. The actual spinning tombstones actually become a transition move for him. He actually does the landslide tombstone now to set up the Rainmaker for the finish. Would you call it a transition move if it's a move that you do that's kind of a finisher, but you're doing it out of desperation and don't immediately go for the pin just because you're just doing it to get out of a bad situation?
Yeah, I don't think if we've settled on I think transition move is used a little more broadly than it probably ought to be. You know, it's like Eskimos have how many words for snow? You know, it's like we might need more words for X finishers or any signature move that's used in a circumstance that doesn't lead to a pin. And, you know, different ones are used under different circumstances. In New Japan, there's, thought put into it and calculation and strategy in terms of when it's used and when it's not. And that's better than just doing it to get a pop or to make a match, you know, quote, more exciting.
So in the 80s, the pile driver was protected as a finisher. And in 2022, the one-winged angel is protected as a finisher, right? I mean, there are things that are protected as finishers, and the previous finishers move down the dance card. And that's not my, you know, my original thought. That's I talked about that a couple weeks ago, as mentioned.
And,
so, I mean,
and I think
yes, I'm okay.
I don't think this Scott Irwin's superplex off the second rope was a finisher in the AWA circa 1986. And I'm not advocating for that because it's not. It's just that's not a timeless finisher. But lifting someone upside down and driving their head into the mat and compressing their neck while leaping in the air or dropping to your knees or having your feet be pushed by somebody else, just from a pure internal logic standpoint, is different than, you know, and I think that's sort of, you know, even Steve Austin's argument for the DDT, but I think the physics of a pile driver is just something where it's like, I don't know if you want to use that the same way that you use other moves where somebody 8 seconds later is not selling it. And so it's just about context and not using it because you're cashing in on the fact that the move was protected before and now you're going to get a you know, quote unquote believable near fall out of doing it again, or OMG facial reaction from some people in the crowd that somebody no sold it. But again, it's nuanced. Doesn't boil down to wanting to go back in time with everything, but certain things like if Vince Russo took over the New York Times and everyone ended every other sentence with 3 exclamation marks, you wouldn't go, well, that's the new thing we do. And it would be going back in time to go back to periods and actually using words to express yourself instead of excessive punctuation. No, you got to pull back and do what makes sense structurally. And it stands the test of time, except when, you know, an idiot is the editor of the paper. And so some of that applies to some of the wild, wild west that isn't just AEW, but is sometimes, you know, the excessive no, high spots dives, big spots, no selling, just to go nonstop, to exhaust your audience and numb them to things.
I didn't think you were going to surpass your shooting heroin on live television analogy from earlier tonight in the show. But man, you just did it.
Very good. Javier, what else?
This conversation was the one thing I do like about the DDT becoming a transitional move is that it led to the – because that was always my favorite move because Jake the Snake growing up was one of my early favorite wrestlers. The one thing about the DDT kind of becoming a transition move that I like is the fact that it led to the creation of all these variations, like the implant and the double arm and the reverse and all those, you know, so I, at least that was the positive of that.
And honestly, what defines a move being a finisher versus a transition is simply pausing briefly before you do it. Like that means your opponent's so beat up, you're pausing for drama, you're building up to the moment, and then you do it. And whatever you do after you do that has more believable as a finisher than just doing something rapid fire.
Hmm. Okada would be the prime example of that. They literally zoom out for his arms in the air before the Rainmaker. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The and I do want to you already talked about this, but the Keith Lee and Swerve thing was just I literally thought that I had turned on. Well, okay, not literally, but I'm using that wrong. But I really did, you know, figuratively think that I turned on WWE by mistake because this was like torn out of the pages of a WWE script. It was just, you know, with them trying to get the rub from a rapper and all that stuff to the point of a wrestler getting knocked out by, granted it's Tony Nese, but, you know, a wrestler getting knocked out by a non-athlete. That I hated that segment so much.
Yeah, I'm not sure that script would have made it through the writer's room and Vince McMahon's red pen either. But I know what you're saying. But I think WWE would have done that awful idea better. I think I'm willing to say
no. That is the sad thing. That's what actually my thought when I was watching that it was like this is WWE one, but like they've done this better. You know, it would have come out better, and which is really disappointing because I saw on Twitter the post match after they won the titles, and you know they were sitting one of the roadie boxes, and they had this great, you know, moment, you know, and talking about what it means, and Swerve basically put to rest the fact that the bad blood, and he talked about, you know, he talked about the you know, the battle royal, you know, betrayal, and that you know, he let the moment get the best of him, and he felt, you know, he felt very sincere in it, and which makes me think that Keith Lee is the one who's going to turn heel at some point. He was very sincere with that, with the apology, and, you know, all this stuff, like, would have served them a lot better if this were on TV than what they did.
I don't want to not talk about this, and I'm thinking about it right now based on you talking about Keith Lee turning. What do you guys think of Luchasaurus switching sides already to go back to Jungle Boy? Is there a chance of a swerve? Are they pulling the plug on something? Go talk about that. Whoever just spoke up.
So this is the only thing we haven't really covered tonight is that angle. And I think they've got just the calendar will tell you why it is more likely than not that the Luchasaurus thing is a swerve. But, you know, I found the whole thing that Luchasaurus is being blackmailed to be like dark Luchasaurus, goofy. Right. As much as Christian Cage has been keeping it real with his promos, that part has always been weird and goofy, but they got six more Dynamites before All Out. Presumably they're going to save Christian Cage and Jungle Boy for All Out. So they got to fill this with something. Right. And a natural thing to do would be to have Jungle Boy, Luchasaurus, you know, turns on Jungle Boy, next week or in the next couple weeks, and then Jungle Boy, you know, decides he's got to beat some sense into his old tag team champion partner friend, and you know, you can leave that hanging, or Luchasaurus can come out of it after that. But you got to do something to fill time with this angle, unless they plan to do a series of matches with Christian Cage and Jungle Boy, like a two match series. So that's my perspective on that.
I have not replayed in my head everything Luchasaurus has done since he turned heel. Is this something where you'd go, oh, yeah, he really – I mean, like, beating up Pillman and Garrison doesn't make you heel. Like, double choke slamming them. Like, so has he done anything so dastardly that you can recall that it's not even believable Jungle Boy would want to stand next to this guy, or that he would just instantly trust him? Like I said, I just haven't a chance to kind of replay in my head how believable it would be for Jungle Boy to believe that Luchasaurus was either always faking it or broke away from the blackmail or the spell that Christian had him under. Like, what is the story that they tell, and is it believable based on what they've done the last several weeks?
Wade, do you know what would have helped you remember that? A video package.
At least on Dynamite, I don't think there's been anything other than taking some liberties with Griff after the bell, but I think that got stopped by Pillman or I believe that got stopped somehow. So it before it went too far, but outside of that, I think that's about it. It's only been like 2 weeks.
I think he put him through a table, didn't he? Didn't Griff go through the table? It didn't break the first time, and then it broke the second time.
Well, yeah. Or I think he threw Pillman through the table or something like that. Some aggressive stuff, but nothing, you know, I mean, and if they had it planned, because that's the thing, because I don't trust their body language necessarily, but this felt more like Luchasaurus was in cahoots all the time with Jungle Boy, as opposed to, you know, there was a switch of allegiances where he was like leaning towards Christian because he was there, and then when he sees Jungle Boy, he's like, no, I'm with you now. It may be a triple cross where, you know, it might end up being a triple cross, and we're entering, again, we mentioned them a few times already, Russo territory. But so I won't discount that either. But me personally, now that he's stand by him, I'd rather it not be a swerve and then actually work together, and then Christian bring in another big guy that I'm sure they've got lying around somewhere. Bring back the other Cage. Brian Cage.
Oh, yeah.
Cage squared.
Maybe Luchasaurus is really with Jungle Boy, but Christian thinks he sent Luchasaurus as a double agent to lull Jungle Boy into a false sense of security. But in reality, Luchasaurus and Jungle Boy are plotting it. Yeah.
When you get to a quadruple cross, that's where, yeah.
So the problem is the main two guys in the storyline are Christian Cage and Jungle Boy, not Luchasaurus. If Luchasaurus were the star of this particular, you know, triangle, you can go with the Return of the Jedi finish, where Darth Vader, spoiler alert, Darth Vader throws the Emperor down the mineshaft to save his son, Luke Skywalker. But that's, he is not the protagonist of this particular saga. It's Christian and Jungle Boy. So who
yeah.
really cares, I guess? I mean, I guess I would prefer that the heel thing was ill-advised and that he's, you know, it seemed like he was being blackmailed or under a spell or whatever. Jungle Boy getting a win over Luchasaurus, especially when Jungle Boy's sort of been used to do more jobs than he probably should have, as they're trying to make him a star. I don't think that's the worst thing in the world for Jungle Boy to get a win over Luchasaurus.
Javier, if Brian Cage and Christian Cage team up, what is their tag team name? And you can answer that and then make your more important point you're about to.
Well, I like your Cage Squared. I like that. I think I really can't come up with it. I think you named them. But you should get royalties of that.
Cagey, out cagey everyone. I don't know.
Oh, no, that's hard.
All right, go ahead.
I wasn't trying to be good. I do want to point out, did you see his shirt, Christian Cage's shirt?
Yeah, worked, period, everyone, period, that one?
Yeah, because I love that, because his motto was outwork everyone, that was his old shirt.
Yeah.
And now it's just worked everyone. I really enjoyed that. I was like, that is, if that was planned from the start, that you know, that outwork everyone thing, because we always assumed that, you know, that's like a heelish thing to say, that he works harder than everyone else, and then the change just worked everyone. I got a big kick out of that, probably bigger than I should have, but yeah.
I feel bad for the guy in the front row who had the earnest Christian babyface outwork everyone T-shirt from before the heel turn, and he finally got to go to AEW in Duluth, Georgia, and I'm going to be there with my Christian T-shirt. And now that's so, you know, 2021.
Well, I mean, you could just get some black electrical tape and tape it over the
yeah.
words.
Or actually, you got to add ED period, but yeah.
But yes, that pretty much is it from what I had written down.
Another thing we barely talked about, and it's just the ROH pay-per-view hype. So maybe we can wrap up with that. Eric, what'd you think of the job that they did hyping the pay-per-view? Was it just enough and it didn't get in the way, but if people want to get it, they know what it is? Or did they, if you're going to do it, you know, like, why, like, do more than have Ian Riccaboni and Jonathan Gresham talk and have Claudio give a heartfelt promo and passionate promo about what this would mean to him. And like, your thoughts. Eric.
Oh, sorry. I really can't wait for the Willow Nightingale Allison Cage K pre-show match. Boy, that's a main event in no arena in the country. The six-man tag team champions being defended, the Righteous versus Dalton Castle and the Boys, is the very worst of the end of ROH's Sinclair tenure, when there was like no star power and it was lame. Look, they had to hype this pay-per-view, right, tonight? I mean, they're putting it on. They don't have an ROH weekly show yet. At some point, I wonder when Tony Khan just gives up and turns one of the darks into an ROH show, if you can't get sell it to a streamer or get another hour of TV on Warner Brothers Discovery.
He does not have to give up a dark to have an ROH TV show on YouTube.
Oh,
don't
no.
Count on that. Just like, you don't have to give up a title to add a title.
So it would be five nights a week then, right? One Dynamite, Rampage, two darks, and a ROH? Oh, no. I don't know where
probably
you would
two
tape
ROH.
That. I don't know where you would tape that. But, but you know, that said, out of the paper,
the Murphy Rec Center?
Personally, I'm looking forward to Wheeler Yuta and Daniel Garcia. I am looking forward to looking forward to the Briscoes and FDR very much. And I guess Jonathan Gresham and Claudio, Jonathan Gresham is just too short to be credible. I know I probably will that may not be a popular opinion.
You've just been rocked by lightning.
Yeah, but
between Adam Cole and
Adam Cole needs to work out a little bit more, as do I. I don't know. The first pay-per-view was a novelty. This one, I'm not as high on, and shows their sort of limitations now. But I'm sure the work will be mostly good, and it's almost worth buying just to see what FTR and the Briscoes can do in their 2 out of 3 falls match. And I'm sure Gresham Castagnoli will be a well-worked match.
Javier, what do you think? Because, I mean, they checked the box with the video package with Gresham and Ian Riccaboni talking. They checked the box with Jay Lethal briefly talking about Samoa Joe and Sanjay ranting. They checked the box with Danny Garcia being shown watching Wheeler Yuta on a monitor. And they checked the box with FTR cutting a promo in the ring. So four of the big matches on the show got some time, and then you had Excalibur mentioning it during plug time before the main event. Is that about what you expected? And with the time they gave it, do you give them a thumbs up, or and did it deserve more or less time or different framing?
Well, I haven't been following the RH stuff too closely because I so fell off of that, and I haven't built the interest to it. And considering the fact that until you mentioned it right now, I had completely slipped my mind that that's the pay-per-views this weekend. Considering the fact that I was not interested, so I didn't really pay really close attention to when they were doing the promo stuff, except for the FDR one. That I think it was unobtrusive enough for the people who don't have interest in it, but at the same time didn't really build interest in it unless you were already into the whole idea of FTR and the Briscoes. A lot of the criticism of Forbidden Door, I think I have more of those feelings towards this pay-per-view than the other one. Plus, this, but then again, this is also not an AEW branded pay-per-view. So, the only match I'm really excited for this is the FDR Briscoe one, and that's about it. And I mean, and Samoa Joe, Jay Lethal keeps mentioning that, when is he going to come to work? And I'm like beginning to agree. I should never be a start to agree with the heel because where has Joe been? considering
voiceover work, Javier. Voiceover work.
Also considering.
Or wait, no, he's starring in a TV show, right? I mean, and somebody else is doing the voice. Is that what it is?
Legit, no, I think he's doing. I think he's doing the voice for somebody else.
Okay, got it.
So it's like, and he's the TV champ, which I thought was like the one who shows up on TV, and not just the pay per views. And one thing I do want to mention is, did they even plug Deeb and Mercedes Martinez? Did they do anything with that?
I was going to ask you guys if I missed it. I don't think they did. Or I don't recall anything.
On Rampage, the only pay-per-view match, to build the pay-per-view is Jay Lethal versus Christopher Daniels. So you'll get a little bit more on Rampage to whet your appetite, such as it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they might do something with Mercedes and Serena promo or something on Rampage would be my guess. Not super. I'm not gonna say that they really got me too interested in forking over any kind of money to watch the.
It's $40 too, I think. It's not, I think the last one might have been $20 or $30, but this one, 40 seems a bit high to me for an ROH show at this point. But, that tag match is really just for work rate nerds. Can they top what they did in April? That's the only hook for me. Jay Lethal, I am not a fan of. Jonathan Gresham, good wrestler, kind of boring, but oof. Do we have buy rate predictions for the ROH pay-per-view?
No.
No.
Javier, do you?
I'm thinking it might end up even being less than the first one, so that would be my only prediction.
Yeah. I don't know, 17,212. That's
what was the high, your high number there? Yeah. I'm going to go with 20,000 on the low end, same as the first one, and 50 on the high end, just because it got so much real estate tonight.
Yeah.
And if you happen to have a way, do you know the percentage of the Forbidden Door from the previous pay-per-view?
Forbidden Door was 127, and I think Revolution was it 160 or in the 160s somewhere?
Yeah, I was just looking at that. So Forbidden Door, WrestleNomics has 127, Double or Nothing 155, Revolution 165, Full Gear 145. All Out a year ago, though, 205, you know, with Punk's first. That was a bit of an outlier with so many acquisitions. I don't know what the percent is. But,
yeah, because 80% was what I would expect. So lower than that would be bad. Higher than that would be good. That was what my over-under was on that.
For Forbidden Door?
Yeah. So I thought Forbidden Door was going to be 80%.
Yeah, it did 82.
It did
82% of the average of the previous three pay-per-views since All Out.
Okay, so slightly higher than I thought it was going to be in the ballpark.
But within the margin of error, Javier, you don't need to. You did well. Yeah. That's right at that point. Give yourself credit.
Which means that. With better promotion, what I should have done better.
It's weird, yeah.
So I think I do have a question for Eric. Just Eric, real quick, what are your thoughts of, like, just brief thoughts on the G1 so far?
I watched the two weekend shows. I have yet to catch up to night three. I can see we're not going to have – there's going to be a lot of really lonely nights watching the G1 this year. Today, in fact, may have been one of them, night three, from what I'm seeing online. I think I liked the first two nights. I liked several matches on each night. So, to me, it's a win. I have yet to catch up to your review of night one and two, but give us a plug for your review and what's your bottom line on the first two nights. Yay or nay?
Yeah. I mentioned that I don't want to the review overall, because when they first announced it, I had some misgivings of, you know, once I saw the new format and stuff, that I some issues, which, you know, particularly the third night really popped up, where your main event, your main event was okay, but like the card of the four matches were just, they were just, you know, I mean, if you're a fan of Goto, also part of the problem is I'm not a fan of Goto. Today was just a rough day, and I want to get more episodes behind me, because I'm not feeling it in the new format. It just feels that too many wrestlers, and they didn't really fill it with high level talent, and it feels like we're getting just less high level matches per show than we were getting before. But that's just my initial impression. Hopefully, you know, it changes going into the future, but that's my initial, you know, gut reaction. You can find out more thoughts on the New Japan Pride podcast on VIP. I've already covered the first two nights, and the third one I'll be recording tomorrow once I finish watching the prelim matches.
Excellent. We will wrap up on that note. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Eric Kroll, for co-hosting. Thank you, Javier, for calling in and being part of the roundtable. Thanks to our callers and our emailers and our listeners and really everybody else, even people who didn't listen and participate or doing something else tonight. Thanks to you, too. Why not? We'll be generous. Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Javier.
You're welcome. Have a good one.
All right.